You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everyone. I thought we would get off to a timely start here. I'm Jonathan Pollack, director of the John L. Thornton China Center here at Brookings, and I welcome all of you to what I am sure is going to be a very, very lively day of discussion. This is the third year in a row that Brookings has collaborated with Caixin Media in this forum, and we value this relationship very, very much. I want to acknowledge Hu Shili, the driving force behind Caixin Media, who, of course, is with us today and will appear on the second panel. I think we have a very, very challenging set of issues here to address today as part of all the continuing challenges that China faces as it makes its continued transition to a modern economy, all in the context, of course, of the just-completed transition in the Chinese leadership. In four separate panels today, we will try to tackle specific elements of China's economic paths that have both domestic and, of course, broader international implications. Beginning first with what I think will be a very interesting panel on China's outbound investment, particularly as it begins to affect increased Chinese investment in the United States. We'll then turn to the very large questions related to transitions in China's financial system. We have some very, very innovative presentations that will be made today. We will then switch to the strategic context of the U.S.-China economic and energy relationship, and we're thrilled to have with us this morning Zhang Baobao, who has been with us in the past, who will provide important insights, I think, from his senior leadership in the Chinese energy sector. And then finally, some of the overall challenges that are faced to both sustaining and implementing the reforms underway in China today. All of us look forward to a wide-ranging debate. It's interesting that in today's Financial Times, we see reports, not unexpected reports, but telling nonetheless, of China's leaders acknowledging a slowing of economic growth and of the need for, frankly, a different economic model as China pushes to the next stage of innovation and growth in its development process. So without further delay, I'm going to ask the first panelist to come up to the stage. Wang Shuo, good to see you. Yeah. Yeah.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome. My name is Wang Shuo. I'm the managing editor of Caixin Media and the moderator for this session. We are going to discuss China's overseas investment. This topic has been very hot for the past decade, and I believe that it will continue to be even hotter in the coming years, because our foreign reserves is still getting bigger and bigger, and we must find a way to spend it wisely, and everybody is trying to help. With no more ado, let me introduce our panelist today, Jiang Frisbee, president of the U.S.-China Business Council, Arthur Kroeber, non-resident senior fellow of Brookings Tsinghua Center, Zhang Lannan, managing director and CEO of CICC U.S. Securities. So I'm sure we will have a very rich discussion today. Arthur, why don't you kickstart?
Thank you very much, Wang Shuo. I just want to make a few comments that hopefully will put the discussion of China's outward direct investment in context. So what I'd like to do is share with you a kind of an overview of, if we look at China's outward capital flows, broadly speaking, what the characteristics are. Some data on the direct investment specifically, and then a few comments on some of the issues that I think get involved in discussing what's the potential growth path for Chinese outward investment and what kind of issues it's likely to create with partner countries. So if we look at sort of the three major types of outward capital flows, those would be direct investment by companies, portfolio investment by financial institutions and asset managers, and loans. What we can see is that in the direct investment side, China's outward capital flows are growing quite rapidly and becoming much more diversified, both in terms of the types of entities that are making these investments and the types of investments that are getting made. If we look at portfolio investment, basically there's very little. There's almost none from the private sector. Portfolio investment flows are still overwhelmingly dominated by a couple of official agents, mainly the State Administration of Foreign Exchange, which manages the official reserves, which now exceed $3 trillion, and the China Investment Corporation, which is the main sovereign wealth fund. There basically is not any significant private outflow of portfolio capital, and I'll get back to some of the issues involved with that later. And then if we look at the loans, again, this is overwhelmingly dominated by the official sector. International activities of Chinese commercial banks are pretty limited. And in fact, my impression is that after a kind of a flurry of interest in sort of 2007, 2008, and 2009, Chinese banks have really commercial banks have kind of retreated to their home shores. So again, if you look at outward loans, it's dominated by official entities, notably the China Development Bank. So I think what we have is a picture where China is seeing a significant increase in its outward investment flows, but the channels through which these investment flows go are still very narrow and still highly state-dominated. When we look at the direct investment specifically, I think that's probably going to be a big part of the discussion that we have with the other panelists. What we can see is up until about 8 or 9 years ago, China really didn't have any outward direct investment. There was a tiny, tiny number of sort of big-ticket resource deals. But then around about 2006 or so, you began to see a big increase. And depending on how you measure it, China's outward direct investment flows are probably running in the order of about $70 to $80 billion a year, which is a pretty large number. That makes China one of the biggest sources of outward direct investment in the world, along with the United States. And the total stock of Chinese outward direct investment is probably on the order of about $400 billion. Which is a significant number, but I think it's worth remembering that the comparable figure for the United States would be about $3.25 trillion. So China is still, in terms of its total stock of outward investments, it's only about one-tenth the level of the U.S. stock, even though the economy is about half the size of the U.S. economy. So I think that gives you, a reminder that for all its size, China is still relatively limited in terms of its international engagements, although those engagements are growing quite quickly. If we look at the composition of that word direct investment, the data that we have for 2012 from various private consulting firms basically looks at mergers and acquisitions activity. So this doesn't include greenfield investment in, you know, for example, mining assets. We can see that there was just shy of $40 billion of Chinese mergers and acquisitions activity internationally last year, which was up significantly from the previous year. The biggest single target area was Europe, which accounted for about 60% of the total outward investment. U.S. Accounted for, had about, I think, about half as much as the European, as Europe did. The Chinese investments in Europe have accelerated dramatically in the last 2 years, And I think there's a broad perception that a lot of what's going on is that because of Europe's economic difficulties, there are a lot of industrial assets that are available fairly cheaply. And so Chinese industrial firms are picking these up. And indeed, Europe accounts for about 60% of China's outward direct investment M&A activity, but nearly 90% of China's outward investments in industrial firms. So that clearly is a big part of the story. And there are a couple of big names, German machinery companies and so forth, that were acquired last year by Chinese firms. Broadly speaking, however, it's still the case that about 60% of China's outward direct investment is accounted for by resource assets, so coal, oil, gas, and so forth. That has basically been the story for a number of years. I think it's slowly changing, but there's still a very strong preference for resource assets. The other characteristic that's very clear is that despite a significant increase in the volume of private sector companies going out and doing acquisitions globally, outward direct investment at least in the M&A area for which we have good numbers is still dominated by state-owned firms. Last year, about 86% of outward direct investment was conducted by state-owned enterprises, and only 14% by private enterprises. So corporations, state-owned corporations in China, I think, are sort of a more complicated entity. We can't really describe these as being purely official in the sense that the State Administration of Foreign Exchange or the China Development Bank are essentially official channels of outward capital movement. But still, what we see broadly is a picture where state actors of one kind or another are by far the dominant players in all types of outward capital flows. I want to make a brief detour just for a minute before I conclude on a distinct but I think related issue, which is the role of the international renminbi market that the Chinese government has tried to set up in Hong Kong over the last few years. Partly this is a matter of advertising because, as you'll see outside, I have a monograph that just came out under the Brookings imprint on the question of the internationalized renminbi. But I think it's worth considering the relationship here because basically both outward investment and the renminbi internationalization program are aspects of a capital account that is very, very slowly and gradually opening up after years of China essentially operating as an island where both capital outflows and capital inflows were very tightly regulated. I think there's been a lot of excitement about the opportunities both of the renminbi offshore market in Hong Kong and sort of more generally the idea that as China's financial sector liberalizes over the next several years, that this will necessarily bring in train with it a substantial liberalization of inward and outward capital flows. And I think there is some very interesting motion there, but I think it's worth stepping back. I've painted a picture in terms of the outward capital flows of outward capital still being going through a very narrow set of channels, most of them dominated through this, by the state. And despite efforts to increase the opportunities for outward portfolio investment by Chinese individuals and institutions, I think that's likely to maintain itself for a long period of time. And similarly, if you look at the role of the renminbi market in Hong Kong, it's grown quite quickly, but from a very small base, so it's still quite modest. And I think that it has yet to live up to its promise as a mechanism by which different kinds of foreign capital can flow into China. So if you look at the inbound capital into China, it's still heavily, heavily dominated by the traditional direct investment channels. And I don't think that's going to change much in the next few years. And the reason, I think, is quite simple. Fundamentally, You can talk in abstract terms about sort of an asymmetric capital account opening where you open it more on the inflow side than on the outflow side or whatever. That's sometimes talked about on the basis that Chinese government is very concerned if they open up the capital account to outward flows, then you'll just get huge amounts of capital flight, etc. I think the reality is that you can have a little bit of asymmetry, but fundamentally, as you open the capital account, you're going to have to open up both outward and inward flows at, over time, roughly the same pace. And I think that China really over the next 3 or 4 years is not in a position to do this. And the reason is that, as we'll discuss in the financial liberalization panel later this morning, China is essentially trying to move into out of a system of financial repression and artificially low interest rates to an environment where interest rates are determined more by the market and are probably higher. And they're doing this at a time where everyone else in the world, all of the other major economies, are trying to keep their interest rates as close to zero as possible. So if China aggressively opened its capital account, I think what would happen in the short term is that instead of having capital flight, which some people worry about, you'd have the opposite. You'd have an enormous inflow of short-term capital from the rest of the world simply because the returns on short-term investments in China would be much, much higher than in the rest of the world. So I mention this because as we look, I want to conclude with a few comments on the sort of the constraints and the issues involved in China's outward direct investment. I think the fact that China is essentially stuck in a position where the capital account, for safety's sake, has to remain relatively closed for the next 3 or 4 years probably, is one constraint that operates on the patterns of outward direct investment, because I think what that means is that the government's going to be very, very reluctant to allow outward direct investment to go out of its current relatively narrow channels. I think there will be diversification at the margin, but the basic picture of outward investment being dominated by state actors of one kind or another, I think, is not likely to change in the next 2 to 3 years. So I want to conclude just with a couple of other thoughts about the difficulties that Chinese entities face in terms of their outward investments and the constraints on expanding this. And I think in China there's a lot of focus, particularly in the media, on the political constraints that various other countries, particularly the United States, are not welcoming to Chinese direct investment, that there's suspicion here. And I think that is severely overblown. I think there are a couple of sort of high-profile instances where you can point to political factors, but if you look at the patterns of on-the-ground direct investment, both in the United States and Europe, you can see that there's been very rapid growth despite these problems, and the vast majority of Chinese investment proposals, whether it's in the U.S., Europe, Australia, Latin America, Africa, et cetera, they go forward without political constraints. So I think that's an understandable concern, but I think it's overblown. Instead, I think I would focus on some other problems. Number one, state-owned enterprises account for a dominant proportion of the foreign direct investment coming out of China. And some people make the case that because they have a low cost of capital that they have kind of an unfair advantage on that. But I think it's also the case that they've run into a lot of operational difficulties in many of their investments, and the failure in many cases to execute properly on deals, I think, offsets some of the capital cost advantage. So, and I think that the difficulties of operating in external markets are becoming more and more clear to Chinese entities, and that's making, in some cases, people a little bit more cautious. I think another thing is that we're now in the midst of what appears to be a very sustained drop in global commodity prices, to the extent that Chinese outward direct investment has been driven by a notion that commodity prices are high and it's important to gain access to resources. I think a substantially lower commodity price environment, which I think is permanent, will act as a brake on some of these deals. And then finally, I think there are big problems at home, both for the state-owned enterprises that are doing a lot of these deals and for the banks that are financing them. As we'll discuss later in the morning, China's undergoing a very substantial transition to a different type of growth model. And the state-owned enterprises, who played a major, major role in the success of China's high-growth model over the last 10 years, do not have as an obvious place in a more consumer and service-driven economy in future. Already, the return on investment and return on assets among the state-owned enterprises in industry has stagnated and is dramatically lower than it is for private enterprises. So I think as we go ahead, my suspicion is that the state-owned enterprises that have driven a lot of the foreign direct investment from China over the last 2 years will find themselves more and more constrained by their operating difficulties at home and will, at the margin, face some constraints in both their willingness and their ability to execute on large-scale deals internationally. And I think with that, I'll pass it over to the next speaker. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Arthur. And Arthur has presented us with a very comprehensive picture of Chinese outbound investment. Now let's hear from Zhang Nannan. Let's hear from Zhang Nannan, a Chinese banker in America. Please. It's not working.
So good morning, everybody, and thank you very much. It's a great honor to have a chance to speak at Brookings again this year. I feel very honored to be invited here, given we just had about 3 years experience relocated from China and working for a Chinese investment bank, trying to help some of the capital outflow from China, as just mentioned by Arthur, and I think it was a very good summary of what's going on and the statistics. So my focus will actually be linked to exactly what we saw on the ground, what was happening. So for CICC, we are our main business model here, including sales trading, asset management, and investment banking. So that will basically cover the majority of the outflows that we were hoping that we can catch. For example, our sales trading business model was catering the institutional investors who would want to invest in U.S. We have the U.S. equity trading capabilities here in on the ground, and the investment banking group hopefully were trying very hard to catch some of the merger acquisition opportunities. And asset management is another form of helping the Chinese who want to invest and diversify their portfolio into the rest of the world. So let me start with what we saw on the ground. One thing I think Asa mentioned that was because of the capital control and asymmetric capital control, seemingly the Chinese government is encouraging more inflow into China rather than outflow to diversify in to invest in the rest of the world. What we saw, interestingly, on the statistics, is actually quite different. If you look at the QDI, qualified domestic institutional investors, we actually have a lot more quota than that was being used. Roughly, we had about $80 billion U.S. dollar quota. Very limited amount of that quota was actually being used for investing outside of China. What was going on there? What happened? I think if you look at back in year 2007, when the famous story of about the direct train, the direct through train, which allowing the Chinese investors to invest in Hong Kong, that wasn't going on very well. It was almost at the peak of Hong Kong market. The Chinese retail investors were allowed to invest in Hong Kong. And that was a huge blow to the domestic investors. Years after that, we all know the reason, the financial crisis, global-wide. A lot of those investors saw 50% loss in their portfolio. I think that was the first step that wasn't faring well. And then Most recently, I think the last couple of years, we do see the QDII start to perform a little better than in the past, not just in Hong Kong, but also I think a very limited exposure to the rest of the world as well. But unfortunately, if you look at those QDII, mainly consisted of banks, insurance, investment banks. If you look at where they were heavily investing in the last couple of years, it was the Hong Kong market. Again, that strategy didn't work out. We all know that the Hong Kong market was underperforming the developed countries for the last 2 years. So the QDII, the Qualified Domestic Institutional Investor Strategy, didn't work very well for the domestic investors. So what does it tell us? For me, I think what I saw was really a lack of knowledge on the global asset allocation. If you look at what happened in the past number of years, first of all, we didn't get the region right. Second, we didn't get the asset class right. So, you know, if you couldn't get your strategy right, if you don't know how to allocate your assets global-wide, not just to say that you stick to one strategy, which was equity strategy in the past, was the Chinese investors focusing on when they were in the domestic market. That's not going to work out. Chinese need to learn how to look at the world from a global perspective rather than looking at the world from a Chinese perspective. And that's a huge knowledge gap over there. I mean, that's understandable. Look at how this part of the world has been investing global-wide. It was much longer history. And we just started, you know, less than 10 years ago. And so I think that knowledge gap, I think over the next decade, it is going to be narrowed. And hopefully, you know, it will be narrowed. And we start as a Chinese investment bank to introduce our perspective, and we start to not in terms of covering the U.S. multinationals, but we start to follow them, their Chinese strategies, what they're doing, and that is gaining a lot of attention in the domestic institutional investors. And I think that's very, very positive. And we're also working with some of the multinationals here for their China NDR, which is non-deal roadshow. So we brought Chinese, the management from multinational companies to do their roadshow in China, to visit the Chinese institutional investors. At the very beginning this year, we brought one of the Fortune 500 CEO to China. And surprisingly, a lot of the Chinese institutional investors found it very difficult to take on that meeting. I told them this is like the greatest opportunity. You learn the strategy, you learn how they manage, you learn how they view the world. But the problem is that they don't, the Chinese institutional investors, since they haven't been spending as much time on the rest of the world, they were even very hesitant to take on the meeting because they felt, am I going to be able to ask the right question? So I think all over the times, I see very positive trend. I see there is a desire for that knowledge, and I think it's going to happen in the next 10 years. So that's more on the portfolio side, what we need to see before we're going to see people moving on to the next stage. And now I move on to the investment banking side. That part is in fact gaining the most attention, both politically and on the economic cooperation in the last number of years. So whenever people talking about the market situation, they will always on the Chinese side, they will be quoting, you know, look at what happened to the banks. You guys, you know, it took us like 20 years to get lessons. And another widely quoted example would be Huawei. You know, we just cannot get through CFIUS. We don't know what CFIUS is requesting. And that's the difficulties we cannot expand in U.S. And, of course, on the U.S. side, I also heard that, you know, there are a lot of business difficulties for the U.S. Multinationals to invest in China. Well, let's put that aside. I think if In the early 90s, I was working for one of the greatest companies in this country, General Electric. Back then, I heard similar complaints. You know, people were complaining about it's so difficult to do business in China. But it took Jack Welch the commitment, the long-term vision to stay in China. And I helped General Electric to build their first joint venture on the industrial side in China. It was close 2 years afterwards. I mean, there are bound to be some failures. There are bound to be some difficulties. But it takes the persistence to stay in that country and really in the end to see the great profit. I think today GE is the Chinese operation is one of their most profitable operations in the world as well. So put that political side aside, what we really see the difficulties in terms of investing in U.S. I think, again, knowledge is stay on top of the priority list. Do we understand how to do business here? I think many of us are seeing the difficulty, and maybe we have to admit is that we don't understand it very well, and that's understandable. You know, we are only here, you know, for less than 10 years. And if you look at the U.S. companies invested in China, it's 30 years and they're still claiming they don't know how to do business in China. So how much do we know? And also I noticed that culture wide, these are two different cultures. People, not only just in the business world, but also during their day life, you know, they are doing things differently, and both parties need to learn. The I think the positive side is that we do see China is a very open-minded nation. If you look at from the top leaders to the ordinary Chinese, we're sending kids to study in this country. We believe this country has the best education. So with that kind of a commitment and investment, I think over the time, that knowledge gap is going to be narrowed and the way of doing business is going to converge as well. I think both parties are very practical. So over the time, that's likely to happen. But the knowledge gap is something I will be ranked as the number one priority as well. Secondly, I think it's really how do you view investing in North America outside of China? Is that just because it's driven by the central government? I think the government is having a very long-term vision. They want to, they know they understand, from my point of view, that they understand that China needs to become a global citizen. And the way that you become a global citizen is to mingle, to blend it well into a different culture. By investing, of course, at the very beginning, you're going to probably pay the tuition and lose money on that. But over the longer term, I think that's a very important step that China is becoming part of the world and becoming more integrated with the world. So I think that's a very strategic view from the central government, from the CEOs. But at the execution level, things are always turning a little bit different because at the execution level, people probably view that as a very optimistic way of doing business. You know, they will think, you know, because U.S. is recovering and maybe we can make some quick money out of that. And that's why you're seeing all the investment coming out of China. I think that there was a one statistic we failed to mention just now. It was the real estate investment at both the private level and also I think probably at the public sector value as well, level as well. So people take that as an opportunistic view in terms of investing, but that's not going to work. You know, it's not going to be something, you know, you're coming in for 2 or 3 years and you're going to make money and then you don't know what your next step. It has to take a long-term view. You have to be able to know what you plan to do in the next 10 years. But a lot of the situations we saw on the ground when we were helping our clients was that there wasn't a clear strategy. There wasn't a clear long-term strategy. So it was more sort of, oh, you know, my boss asked me to do that. I have to do it. And that's not going to work. So I think secondly, we need to have a different approach to the strategy. I think the third one that I'm seeing is that because the Chinese corporates are working in a totally very different environment. Basically, we have a lot of the sectors in China already very market-driven, but there are also sectors that certain companies have the privilege to have access to capital, human resources, and even, you know, government subsidy, government support. But now they are working in a market economy, which is going to be slightly different. So how do you work in a totally different market mechanism? How do you become part of the community, the investment community, the corporate community? I think that's another challenge we need to face. And I think lastly, what we saw is that for all of what's going on in this part of the world for the investment, but we do need to see reform back in China because, you know, organizational structure, human resources, how you pay your employees, every single details of running a company, that needs to be changed back in China before you can really mingle yourself well into the U.S. Economy. So lastly, I just want to wrap up. Of course, we're facing a lot of difficulties, and I think those noises that we are making, it was totally legitimate. But in the meantime, don't give up. Be persistent, and next 10 years, no matter what's going to happen, we're going to see more investment into this country, either from portfolio or from the Chinese corporates. I don't think it will be stopped. Temporarily setback might happen, but if you look at the trend, it lasts 30 years. Every 10 years, we jump one step, and it was a major step. We're about 10 times about the investment about 10 years ago, so that's not going to change. Thank you.
It's just not working.
Thank you, Nanan. And Nanan identified deep knowledge gap, both for portfolio investors and for business investors from China into U.S. market and other international markets. And one of the solutions you suggest that is to send our kids to study in the United States. I wonder whether we can get a quicker solution. And let's hear more from Jiang and a business perspective. Jiang, please.
Thank you, Wang Chua, and thank you to Hu Shu Li and Jonathan for asking me to participate on this panel. I'm probably going to end up reinforcing some of the messages you've already heard this morning from the other two panelists. As Art said, there's different types of investments to look at, portfolio, financial, into treasuries and equities and so on. And there's foreign direct investment, which is going to be my focus. Let me put a couple numbers on the table that I think will fit in with what Art was talking about. These are from the Rhodium Group up in New York, which does a pretty good job of tracking inbound investment from China from its various sources. Clearly, Chinese foreign direct investment in the United States is increasing dramatically. If you go back 5 years to 2007, maybe you had about 10 deals, less than $1 billion, something like that. If you go to last year, 2012, you probably had over 60 deals with about $6.5 billion in investment. Those numbers aren't complete. They really can only capture the bigger deals that they might get through filing. Some of the smaller deals may not get included, but nonetheless, I think it's indicative of what you heard from both speakers, that Chinese direct investment in the United States is growing rapidly. If you break that down into the different types of foreign direct investment between M&A deals versus greenfield, M&A deals clearly outnumber greenfield investments here in the U.S. for Chinese investors. In terms of numbers of deals, there's about twice as many M&A deals as there are greenfield investments. If you do it by dollar value, even more so, probably over 80% of the foreign direct investment from China in the U.S. is in M&A deals. But the bottom line, as we heard, is that we should all expect these numbers to increase, period. And I think that's a good thing. Why do we like foreign direct investment? Growth, economic growth, and jobs. Very simple. At the same time, I think we all know there's a lot of concern from the Chinese side about whether they're welcome to invest in the U.S. or not. I was actually just in China twice in the last 3 weeks and got to hear this directly from some of the investment leaders at China Investment Corporation, China Development Forum in Beijing. The chairman of China Investment Corporation, Jin Li-chun, on a panel talked directly about barriers they face in investing in the United States. And at the Boao Forum, Gao Xiqing, also at China Investment Forum, also articulated that view too. What are their concerns? Well, one, there is the CFIUS review process here in the United States to review mergers and acquisition deals. And it's very important to remember that CFIUS only looks at mergers and acquisition deals, not at greenfield deals. What are the numbers around the CFIUS reviews? CFIUS does put out numbers. The last full year, I think, was 2011. 111, I think, M&A deals globally, this is inbound, were reviewed. 10 of those were from China, so a little under 10% were from China. Just for context, the UK had 25 deals reviewed, France 14, Canada 9. So China is clearly higher on the list of getting CFIUS reviews. But it's not just the CFIUS reviews. It's actually outside of CFIUS, too, that's causing concerns, and that's the political outcry that has cropped up and led some deals to go astray without ever reaching the CFIUS process or even a deal that might not have required a CFIUS review. What are some examples of this? Let's just choose the wind deals that got a lot of attention. There was a Chinese investment in Oregon that was following a CFIUS review, turned down and denied after the fact. That's a good example of the need to consult early, by the way, in the review process to avoid those types of situations. But the problem there, apparently, was proximity to a military installation. On the other hand, there was a successful Chinese investment in wind in Texas, which was a greenfield investment. And I think that's an important reminder of the fact that it's not just that wind is off limits. There was another reason for that. What do the surveys say about Chinese attitudes towards investing here in the United States? Because we have the anecdotal, and we read the headlines, and we listen to what some of our friends in China say, but it's always good, I think, to go to some survey data to get a little bit better grounded. There's no shortage of these out there, actually. The China Council for the Promotion of International Trade has been doing a pretty good annual survey of Chinese investors every year for the last 3 years. I'm going to cite a recent one that was actually done by China Daily and APCO for Chinese executive views of investing in the United States, and I won't go through it all. You can find the survey online, I'm sure, but one of the questions is around market entry into the United States through the investments, and 94% said that they were very or somewhat successful in entering the United States. That's a pretty high percentage. Wasn't problem-free. When asked about conducting business in the United States, something like 60% said it was very or somewhat easy, but a fair number cited problems. But when they talked about the problems, actually less than 20% cited investment restrictions or anti-Chinese bias as a serious problem. Instead, the types of problems that were cited in the survey that created difficulties for the Chinese companies trying to operate here were around operating costs, HR issues, business culture differences, as we heard a moment ago, regulatory compliance, which I think we can all understand could be a bit daunting. Those were all cited as higher challenges than an anti-China bias towards investment. Lots of Chinese investment is under the radar, so to speak, in a variety of industries. It ranges from consumer products, automotive components, machinery, oil and gas, and, yes, even financial services. ICBC, the Industrial Commercial Bank of China, for example, I think bought something like 80% of the Bank of East Asia's U.S. assets, so a successful investment here in our financial services sector. Another complaint that I hear from Chinese investors, and I've heard this from CEOs in China when we've had our board of directors from the U.S.-China Business Council over there, is about the problems in getting outbound investment approvals from China's government as well, excessive delays that can undermine getting a deal done. So it's not just all issues here. I think Chinese investors also tell you they have a need to see more efficiency on their side in terms of government approvals to invest overseas. So what are some of the solutions to these issues? Well, first thing I think I would come to is this, just for a little context. U.S. foreign direct investment in China in 2012, this is based on China statistics, was around $3.5 billion. Now, I remember a moment ago I said that Rhodium Group here in New York says that Chinese foreign direct investment in the U.S. is about $6.5 billion. Neither of those numbers are probably completely accurate, but I think the one thing that we certainly could take away from it is that the numbers are pretty small. U.S. foreign direct investment in China is about 3% of their total foreign direct investment, not very significant. And as we heard earlier, China's investment here also small, low single digits. That should be the striking takeaway, I think, from those numbers, particularly when you have the two largest economies in the world involved. But when we talk about U.S. investment in China, we have seen through our own survey of our membership in the past 3 years a little bit of a decrease in confidence. It's not turning to pessimism. U.S. investors in China are still largely optimistic or somewhat optimistic, no doubt about that, all for good reasons. But clearly the investment and licensing barriers that U.S. companies faced in China are undermining that confidence a little bit. And I think this brings me to the first thing I would say is that I think both governments need to be doing all they can to mutually reduce investment barriers. And barriers in China that U.S. companies face do impact, I think, attitudes towards Chinese investment here, and that's why it matters. One possible way to get at this is through something like a bilateral investment treaty. There are discussions underway, but I would say that for a bilateral investment treaty to be successful, it's going to be necessary for it to be meaningful. And by that, I mean it would have to address those investment ownership barriers that are in so many industries in China. We keep a list. There's close to 100 areas where U.S. investors are limited in their investment amounts, whether it's insurance or cloud computing or whatever, maybe owning 50%, maybe a minority. I think it's very important for both sides to try to reduce those barriers. Bilateral investment treaty be one way to do it. I don't know if we want to wait that long to have that play itself out. It would be good to be taking some barrier reduction measures in the meantime. We need to continue what's called around here a subnational dialogue, and basically that means outside of Washington, all the work that's done at the state, municipal level to try to attract Chinese investment here. I just mentioned that I was in China a couple of times in the last 3 weeks. So was former Mayor of Chicago Richard Daley. In part, I think, doing just that. California Governor Brown was there this week, last week. I'm losing track of time. Same thing, looking to attract investment. Iowa's Governor Branstad going soon with a couple of other governors. This is going on all the time. Again, we wouldn't see that in Washington, but governors and mayors are doing this for one simple reason. It's what I said earlier. It's economic growth. It's about jobs. They want foreign direct investment to come in. I think that's an important message and an important channel to continue to work. I think Beijing's mayor is actually planning to go to Los Angeles as well in mid-May, perhaps. So that would be another thing to do. A third one would be to continue education programs. I think we just heard about the importance of that for Chinese investors to better understand the environment here. And it comes out in that survey data that Chinese investors find that it can be a challenging environment here to operate in. It's a different one for them. It's a new one for them. Our organization and others need to continue to do as much as we can. Department of Commerce has its Select USA program to try to help Chinese investors get smarter about the environment here. I agree with what was said just a moment ago. U.S. investors had to get smart about China, and it's taken them a long time to do that, and they're still learning all the time. Chinese investors have to go through the same process here. They just need some help. I would also say as part of that, as I mentioned earlier, where a deal might get caught up by a CFIUS review, is to have those consultations with Treasury early rather than later. And a positive example of that would be the Wanda investment where they bought AMC Theater chain here, a big transaction, but they did do that early. I'm not sure that would have been considered a strategic threat, by the way, movie theaters, but nonetheless, they did it the right way, and I think that's something we should also be encouraging, too. There's a few other things here as well around the margins of this that matter, and that's around building trust, around trying to change attitudes. I think more transparency, efforts to improve governance, particularly around the state-owned enterprises, are important. Level playing field issues are important, too, like I said, because I do think that we're at a point in the relationship now where, you know, if the last 3 decades were about China building up its trade volume, the next 10 years and beyond ahead of us are really going to be about bilateral investment and relationship. It's enormously important to make sure that goes right. It's not just about the investment issues themselves. There's a lot of other trust and confidence issues that matter. Yes, things like cybersecurity matter, but it's time, I think, for both sides, like I said, to be working together to try to remove those barriers and try to build trust to make sure that this aspect of the relationship becomes as successful as some of the things that have happened in other parts of the relationship. And finally, in regards to CFIUS, the one thing I would say about it is let's let it do its job. We need to depoliticize the view over here about inbound Chinese investment. CFIUS is set up to work. Let's let it work. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jan. And yes, we agree that the U.S. market is open to international investment, including Chinese investment. Yes, no matter what happens in the future years, that Chinese investment into the U.S. market will grow no matter what happens. But we also cannot avoid talking about Huawei, cases like Huawei, because Huawei is symbolic. Huawei represents the most aggressive Chinese companies investing into the international markets. And in the U.S. market, its effort to expand has been repeatedly frustrated. So I want to ask a question to the whole panel. What kind of specific suggestion you can make to a company like Huawei? What should Huawei do before its expansion to the U.S. market becomes successful? What needs to be done? But Jiang, how about start from you?
My simple answer would be one of the ones I closed on, and that's transparency and governance are important things.
Mm-hmm. So what if it's done? You mean, for example, if Huawei gets listed in the United States stock market, will that help?
I think it also has to do with their decision-making structure back in China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'd say the simplest thing they could do is publish a register of shareholders.
Mm-hmm. I took that a slightly different. I think in Huawei's case, people can definitely say, you know, transparency, governance, but it's a bit shocking why ZTE was also on that list.
Yes.
It was publicly listed in Hong Kong, and the shareholder structure was relatively clear. I think, I just happened to be a telecom analyst for the last 10 years. The way I look at the world and the way I look at Huawei, I think Huawei, if one suggestion that I want to give them is to learn how to operate and in a global environment, how to make sure you compete in a way that is widely accepted by different cultures and the different rules. If you look at what happened, I think, admit it or not, if you look at what happened from a decade ago to now with the rising Huawei and the ZTE, the landscape of the telecom equipment sector has been dramatically changed. There are companies rising. There are companies obviously have been suffering. It just happened to be a sector that is changing very quickly, very fast. And it takes investors, it takes the competitors to absorb that. But how you can make sure that the way you compete is widely accepted and understood, and probably in another way that will become more transparent.
Exactly.
To the others. But that was a myth that has been going on for a long time, that people thought how Huawei can compete and become so competitive in a short period of time. But if you go back to China, if you visit their research center, if you talk to their engineers, one thing you can start to understand much better is that one Huawei engineer, a telecom engineer, is only one-tenth of the cost of the telecom engineer here. And that sometimes tell you it wasn't just the support of the credit from the government. It was really the competitiveness, the slowing down of technology development in the last 10 years in that particular space after the internet bubble that gave Huawei and also ZTE the opportunity to compete in the global market. I think that part, I think the world also need to understand it wasn't just the government support. I think every telecom company, every telecom equipment manufacturers in this world are one way or another getting government project. I mean, if you look at Motorola, where their business is the most profitable, it was Iraq.
I mean, that sort of things, we have to accept that it happens. But on the other hand, I think people need to understand, investors, competitors need to understand how Huawei and ZTE was able to be very successful in the last decade. If Huawei and ZTE can explain to the rest of the world very clearly how that happened, and I think that probably will help them a little bit in the global thing.
Thank you. So the knowledge gap is mutual, right? Thank you. And the discussion is open to the floor. Please identify yourself.
Hi, my name is Eric Lowe. I'm with the Free Observer. My question is that I think that there is a lot of things that I've been concerned about, you know, because, of course, like firms in China like Huawei or others are actually partially owned by the government. And he's talking about like private companies hasn't been able to make a big headway. I think that's a lot of. It actually has been a long time since Americans has been very jittery about any kind of Chinese investment. I remember, you know, like when they talk about, you know, like when Hutchison got the two ports in Panama, and they always talk about like, oh, China is owning the canal already. So that kind of thing. Even though it's a Hong Kong company, but it has China links and everything. So. I think that in opening up the private sector will give people more transparency and more confidence that they're investing in a company, not a government-controlled environment.
And what's your question? Do you have a question?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And just to respond both to that and to the comments that Lan Lan made, I mean, I think it's not just a matter of a company like Huawei or ZTE communicating more effectively what they do. I think the problem is that the entire system in China is a system of very high levels of state involvement, either in direct ownership of companies or in the allocation of resources to companies. This is not comparable to the situation in any other country. I think we have to be very clear about that. The Chinese system of relationship between government and companies is different than in any other country in the world, substantially. And to the extent that most of the outbound investment continues to be either by companies that are explicitly state-owned, like ZTE, or ones which, despite repeated efforts by journalists and analysts to understand what their relationships between with the government are, they can't explain them, which is Huawei's situation. It's been 15 years that Huawei has been the subject of extensive scrutiny by international analysts, and we still don't have any clear answers as to what their ownership structure is and what their relationship is with various government entities, right? So this is not a problem of communication of this or that company. This is a systemic question, and it leads to very understandable suspicion, not just in the United States, but in many other countries which have also had difficulties with companies like Huawei approving investments. It's a systemic failure to get a straight answer about are companies that come out of China, are they purely commercial or are they representing some kind of state agenda that we can't figure out what it is? So I think it's not just the individual companies that have to be more straightforward about this. There's a systemic issue there, and I would agree that to the extent that more and more of the direct investment is by unambiguously private companies, like Wanxiang, the automaker, which has made a lot of investments in the United States, and as far as I know, has not encountered any problems, I think that clearly would be helpful in terms of the overall picture.
Thank you. Chen Jian, please.
My name is Chen Jian, and I teach finance at Johns Hopkins University. So my question is to John. Basically, 4 days ago, the biggest real estate investment of a Chinese firm, China Development Bank, with Lanner, it's about $1.7 billion in size, fell apart. And part of the reason is the China Development Bank insists on the condition using a China construction company, the China Railway Construction Firm. As a general contractor. But it seems that they cannot handle the local labor union conditions really well, so they still basically was canceled. So my question is, if the foreign investment from China come with attached condition like, you know, not only the capital, but also the provision of technology and labor, how will that affect the business side of the local trade union and labor union? Thanks.
Well, as I said earlier, one of the benefits of foreign direct investment, economic growth, and job creation. And if you're trying to build support for making an investment somewhere, the more you are creating jobs, the more likely you're going to get a positive reception. So things that would come with that might reduce the local jobs impact might make a deal less attractive. So that's one point. We have to remember that when some of these deals are going in, it's very important to make sure that I think Chinese investors engage early with local stakeholders so that the messaging going out is going to be a positive one about the job creation and other things. Staying silent early and allowing those who might oppose a deal to speak means you're losing that part of the public affairs stage. The second thing, though, I would point to is, and I don't know the specifics of the deal you're talking about, but I think it supports the point that comes out clearly in all those surveys that I mentioned. Probably one of the top inhibiting factors for Chinese investors in the U.S. is a lack of understanding about the regulatory environment, the HR environment, and so on. It is very different. And it sounds like that might have been one aspect of that.
This gentleman.
Mike Massetti, PBS Online NewsHour. Following up on the HR, I know that European firms, or some European firms, come here, and they have real problems with the American workforce. There was a good story in the FT over the weekend that Siemens, one of the companies in South Carolina, a German company, opened up an investment, and they got 2,000 applications, of which 10% of the people were qualified to do this fairly high-tech work. So are the Chinese firms facing this same thing? And then the other follow-up question I had was, how effective are the various mayors and governors in terms of appealing to Chinese investors? I presume they can be deal openers, but there's no way that they're going to be deal closers.
To which your question is addressed. Sorry. How about you? You answer.
I'm not here. I think I probably have the one that you're in the position to.
Well, on the question about HR issues, again, I can only point to the Chinese survey data. I'm not going to speak for Chinese investors. They do find the HR rules at least are challenging. I don't know if they're finding a talent shortage or not. But I think you raise an important point for the U.S. more broadly, and that is in our economic future, the greater determinant is going to be not necessarily what happens with China, but it's what we do ourselves here to get our own house in order and make sure we remain competitive. And obviously having a competitive workforce, educated workforce, is a big part of that. That's a whole separate issue. But I think that message about our economic future being closely tied to what we do here at home is an important one to remember.
That gentleman over there.
Hi, my name is Jeff Okun-Kozlowicki, and I had a comment and a question regarding the issues of trust and confidence that I think several of the panelists mentioned. And my comment is what when I was working at the Department of Commerce, the U.S. Department of Commerce email systems and computer systems were hacked by through computers originating in China. That same year, Huawei came in to meet with myself and several other Department of Commerce officials to stress, as they have done repeatedly, that they have no links to the Chinese government. I think there seems to be a disconnect between what we want and what we're doing. So my question is broadly, what can governments on both sides do, short of perhaps eliminating CFIUS and complete radical transparency in the financial and business system in China? What can both governments do to increase trust and confidence?
Arthur, how about you first?
I guess the first comment I'd make is that I think, I mean, if you look at CFIUS and the analogous processes that exist in other countries for vetting foreign direct investment, typically what they do is they address a very small percentage of the total transactions. And in most cases, they approve everything, right? So, and what CFIUS, I think, was in fact designed to do when it was created in the late 1980s was it was originally designed in response to concerns about Japanese direct investment in the United States. I think the function of these things is, yeah, they may be viewed as obstructive to particular deals, but I think in a broader context, what they do is because they allow for, if you will, they're kind of a political pressure valve. So it gives people who are scared about this or that particular foreign investment wave a way of expressing their concerns, and by, you know, basically obstructing one or two deals, gives the broader investment wave greater credibility because people have the sense, oh, okay, things have been properly qualified, so we don't need to worry. So I would actually agree with John's comment that I think the CFIUS process is extremely important because it validates the broader investment terrain. And I think we sometimes get a little bit too hung up on the particular deal that CFIUS or Foreign Investment Review Board in Australia or comparable organizations might obstruct. I think you're losing sight of the forest for the trees there. So I think point one is having mechanisms like CFIUS, even though like they might be annoying for particular firms, is very important in creating a wider culture of consent for these things. And then the other thing is, I mean, I think, again, I would agree with John that fundamentally the issues obstructing investment, I think, on both sides are not so much political. They have to do with various kinds of investment protectionism that we have or regulatory barriers. And so the issue is just how can we reduce the regulatory barriers? I think that is, in terms of increasing the flow of investment, I think, just doing practical things to reduce the number of regulatory barriers and to make sure that there are enough mechanisms in place to create political consent, I think that's all that you need to do.
I don't think there's a fast fix to the trust and confidence issue, but it's an enormously important one. I would say we need to continue to expand engagement like we saw at the end of the Bush administration, like the Obama administration has done, between the U.S. and China in all facets of the relationship. We need to size the engagement to fit the size of the relationship. So it needs to keep getting bigger, not smaller. Relationships only going to get more important with time, not less important. And yes, all aspects matter, including the strategic military side. So that would be the thing that I would emphasize has to continue to go on. At the same time, I think we heard, you know, on the CFIUS process, that perhaps we can do a better job of trying to explain it as well. But I think it's important for Chinese investors to understand that they can go to Treasury early and consult on a particular deal and maybe avoid some of these outcomes or at least be able to mitigate them rather than have it be a problem after the fact.
Nana, do you want to add something?
Yeah. Well, for my part, I think that, as I agreed, that the trust and the confidence probably won't be changed overnight, improved overnight, but it's always our intention to try to improve that. I think over the years, what I noticed is that maybe on the U.S. side, we need to understand that China is a different country. It's going to improve the transparency. It's going to improve how it communicates with the world. But it's always going to be a country with a very different culture. So it's not going to be, over the years, expecting China to look exactly the same as U.S. I think they eventually still probably going to have a completely different set of values over the time, but they're going to, hopefully they're going to be looking more and more alike. And I think on the Chinese side, the Chinese also need to understand that they are now just an individual country. They are working and operate under a global system. The more they can get themselves understood, the more they can better communicate themselves, the more they can be responding quickly to what's going on in the world, that trust then can be established. I think that always needs more effort. Regarding the CFIS, I don't know. I think it's a bit of a luxury for us to expect that's going to be removed any of the time. I mean, even for China, these days you go there, for your investment, you still need to get approval for certain sectors. And so I think
every single deal has to have government approval in China.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You know, I don't, but eventually, I was being asked in the past, like, do you think the Chinese economy is more open or the U.S. economy is more open? And I can only say, using numbers, if you look at the industrial output, if you look at the industrial value added, this country has much less contribution from foreign-owned companies. China has over 20% of its industrial output coming from foreign owned companies. So I don't want to go through the procedures, process, which one is better than the other ones, but the outcome, it seems China is more open because China was able to get more foreign companies that making contributions and manufacturing in their own country. But that being said, I think that we need to learn on the Chinese side. I think we need to learn the procedures and the process. Every country has its own set of rules. We just need to learn and follow and how to survive and operate in that environment.
Let me come back to the cybersecurity piece of this because it's important. You know, what should companies be doing, American companies be doing? My analogy, it's like if you live in a high-crime neighborhood, you got to make sure you have the best locks on your house, the best security system in place to protect yourself, and that's what companies need to be doing. Who's outside of your house, who the perpetrators are, you don't know that. And that's not your job to be able to try to investigate or figure it out. That's where governments come in. So U.S.-China Business Council Board of Directors in January, as part of our annual statement of priorities, highlighted the cybersecurity issue and basically said that commercial espionage doesn't have a place in the relationship, regardless of where anything might be coming from. It can undermine a constructive commercial relationship, and the two governments need to get together to try to come up with a way to reduce the cybersecurity problem. I think that the two governments are talking now. We would encourage them to move along that path sooner rather than later. China says it's a victim itself of hacking, and I have no reason to not believe that. We know that some of the IT systems over there don't have the best protections in place. I would say, however, that would be even more reason for the two sides to work together, if China's a victim too, to try to reduce this problem. But it is one that needs to be addressed bilaterally sooner rather than later, so it doesn't become more disruptive in the relationship, and it gets right at the heart of your question about trust and confidence.
The discussion is, sorry, it's discussion, oh, please.
I speak in Chinese. I let the translator help me. 我过去在中国政府工作很久，那么我两年前从政府工作岗位上退下了。由于中国现在在海外的投资逐年增多，也让我担任一个叫中国产业海外发展协会的会长，和今天这个讨论题目好像有点切题，是我现在的工作。这个我听下来以后，觉得中美两国。 对双方的认知差距是那么大，比我在中国了解的好像那个 gap 还要大，这是我今天的这个感受，因为我担任这个协会会长，所以对一些中国的大的数据我还是掌握一些的。这个中国去年在美国的投资，只占美国外来投资的 0.5% 刚才你们有一位先生讲是 3%。 看来我这个统计数字比你说的还要少一点，无论是 3% 还是 0.5%， 我想和中美两国的现在的贸易额以及两国的国际地位都是非常不相称的。刚才这个在发言人当中有一位也提到，中国在欧洲的投资占到 60%， 在美国的投资只占到 30%， 就是这个在欧洲的投资。 居然是要比美国要多出一倍，出现这些现象，我觉得都要思考一下，为什么？ 难道都是中国公司的问题吗？都是华为这样的问题吗？还是有别的什么问题呢？所以我听下来，今天好像大家有三分之一都在谈华为，这个到底是什么问题会造成两国政府的投资相互投资那么小？远远和我们的贸易不相称。刚才这个有一位先生谈到，这个在美国的投资受到限制啊，是被夸大了。根据你们的调查呢，94%的投资者认为到美国来投资是成功的。这个数字看起来很乐观啊，但是我也要向大家介绍一些数字。根据我掌握的数字啊，这个中国到美国来投资这个0.5%啊，绝大部分站在第一位的投资，不是大家想象的矿场资源，而是商务、商业服务、零售、批发啊这样一些东西，比如说搞一个餐馆，或者去参加一个连锁店的投资，或者是一个这个超级市场的投资，像这样的一些投资啊，数量大，金额小，可能确实不用受到这个 CCS 的审查。所以因此你调查这些人，他们可能会感到还是满意的，没有受到美国政府过多的审查。但是你看到稍微大一点的投资可就麻烦了，基本上都要受到审查。除了刚才大家谈的比较多的华为以外，像前几年带有很典型案例的就是中海油收购 UNIQLO 公司也被因为这个安全理由受到拒绝。再比如说这个一个民营企业三一重工，就是刚才也提到了，在俄勒冈州要投资一个风电厂，也是因为安全问题也被拒绝了。如果再往前追溯很多年的话，连香港的商人李嘉诚来投资港口也被认为是安全问题，也被拒绝了。这个所以这些事情看起来啊就不是很小的一个，因为你稍微大一点的投资都碰到这个问题。你要是投资开个餐馆，投一个连锁店，当然不需要那个政府投资。另外刚才这个你们两位美国人当中有一位介绍说，到你们中国投资不是每个项目都要审批吗？我立即要更正你一下，因为我在政府工作那么多年，90%以上都不需要政府批准，包括你在中国投资连锁店，如果你要开餐馆也不需要中国政府批准。只有中国政府同样也是一些非常大的一些案子才要到政府来批准，比如说国家发改委明文规定要3亿美元以上的这个才要到国家发改委来批准。大量的这个你要美国人要开一个小饭馆，开个什么连锁店，我想也都不需要政府来批准。但你登记注册的工商登记注册肯定是需要的。所以这些基本认识啊，我觉得中国和美国之间差距实在之大，远远超出我的想象。再比如说又谈到华为，这个大家对华为好像也有很多的看法，怀疑它跟政府到底有什么关系啊。我还真要想讲几句话，你们可以相信我也可以不相信我，因为我呢过去管过中国的信息产业，华为只有十几个人小公司的时候我就认识任正非我就认识他，他确实是不想让政府跟他沾边这是我跟你们讲的。因为等到他发展到一定程度有一定名气的时候啊，原来的总理朱镕基去访问过深圳这个华为公司，当时我也陪同他去了。这个朱镕基看了以后呢，觉得华为发展得很不错，说你们搞得这么好，要不要政府帮助啊？我给你解决3亿贷款好不好啊？当时任正非不敢得罪朱总理，他那么好心想帮助，他就没有拒绝。但事后呢，他坚决不要政府给他安排的贷款，他就要跟政府撇清这个关系。所以像这样一个企业在美国却打上深深的烙印，是跟政府有关系，我觉得真是很奇怪。再比如说任正非，因为他跟我同年人我们俩都是1944年生的人，同年人他确实在中国的军队服过役，但是我想当时他服役时可能不是个好兵因为据我了解，通常在中国军队服役的在他退伍的时候都能参加中国共产党，他没有能够参加上所以他不得不去办个公司所以我就很奇怪，我就讲到美国你们这么多的 CEO 当中难道没有义务为国家去服役吗？ 是你们认为他们为国家服役的人是好人，还是不为国家去服役的是好人？据我了解，在你们美国，能够为国家服役的人是受到尊重的。所以我觉得在这些方面确实有很多政治偏见，不是一般的偏见。这个华为呢，后来成长得很快，确实具有很强的竞争力，这一点一点不假。但是他说他和军方有多少关系，会威胁到美学的安全，我认为完全是个伪命题。我在不久以前的一次国际研讨会上，我曾经讲到，如果认为通讯设备对美国或者对澳大利亚会产生威胁的话，那我们中国每个人都受到你们美国威胁。为什么？我用的手机就是苹果机，那苹果机上都可以定位，天天知道我在什么地方，而且我所有的通话可以说，如果你们要需要的话，肯定都能知道我在说什么，而且中国的很多的工厂里头用的这个控制系统 DCS 全都是买的美国的计算机。那如果我们要像美国人这么思考问题的话，我中国不能用你们美国的计算机，因为我们中国太不安全了。所以今天的会啊，真让我大吃一惊，中国和美国的认知居然这么大的差距。
谢谢你 张主任。And I think our discussion is getting better and better. And Minister Zhang actually just launched a systematic attack on the American side of the perception. And there is a huge perception gap between American side and the Chinese side. And I think Minister Zhang's speech is a vivid example of what's to point out what's going wrong on both sides. And with this, unfortunately, our time is up. With this, we have to conclude our discussion. Thank you. Please join us to thank our panelists.
So I would ask you please all to take your seats, and then we'll begin. So the four panelists we have, you have the bios here, so I won't spend a lot of time, but we'll first have some remarks by Douglas Elliott, who's a fellow at the Brookings Institution, who will give us an overview of the Chinese financial system. Then we'll have some comments from Hu Shuli, the editor-in-chief of the Caixin Group, who's been following financial sector reform in China for many, many years. Then we'll have some comments from Yukon Huang, who spent some time in China as the head of the World Bank mission there years ago, and again as a longtime student of the Chinese financial system. And then we'll have some concluding remarks by Ishwar Prasad, whom I'm sure you all know is one of the leading scholars of the Chinese financial system today. So I will ask each of them to come up in turn, and then after we've completed all the presentations, we will be joined at the front by Andrew Sheng and all of the panelists, and we will take some questions. So please, Doug, can you start us off? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Arthur. And I'd like to thank the sponsors for inviting me here today. I've been asked to lead off with an overview of the Chinese financial system. For those of you who are particularly interested, following Arthur's lead, I'll give my own brief advertisement, which is in the near future I'll be having a more detailed paper coming out on the Chinese financial system. If you're not on the John L. Thornton Center website mailing list, please let me know if you'd like to receive the paper. Broadly speaking, the Chinese financial system has done a good job in the last two decades in keeping up with the truly impressive growth of the Chinese economy. There are definitely ways it could have performed better, but we shouldn't underestimate the sheer difficulty of the financial system evolving fast enough and growing fast enough to keep pace with the underlying economic growth. And my base case is that the future performance of the financial system will also remain pretty good. But there are major risks, and there's a real possibility that the financial system will either trigger or worsen serious economic problems. One of the things that has struck me as I've studied the Chinese financial system is the very wide range of views among people who are each experts in the Chinese financial system. This conflict of views makes it a particularly interesting area of analysis. And it means, unfortunately, none of us can tell you for sure what's going to happen, but We can't even do that with the U.S., which is comparatively a simpler situation. So what does the Chinese financial system look like? Well, it's still very bank-dominated. About three-fifths of the credit in the system, in the formal credit system, comes through the banks. Now, let me just make one technical note here, because there are a number of true experts. China tends to report financing as total social financing, and gives the breakdown of that. That includes some non-credit items like equity financing, foreign direct investment. I'm going to try to give you figures that focus just on the credit component. So the role of banks, for example, will sound higher than if you look just at total social financing. So banks still do provide about three-fifths of the credit, at least that provided by the formal sector. This is down from four-fifths maybe 7 years, 10 years ago, and down from even higher levels, 90% or more, going back further. So you have a very bank-dominated system, but one that is increasingly having credit provided by other parts of the financial system that I'll describe in a moment. Within the banking system, roughly half of the credit is provided by five large banks that are partially owned by public shareholders but are primarily owned by the central government. And the bank sector is, again, I'll go into a little more detail on later, mostly sends money to state-owned enterprises, particularly the large ones. Not just that. They do wider provision of credit. But there's a very strong bias towards the state-owned enterprises. The next big component is the corporate bond market. It's still relatively small compared to, say, developed Western economies, but it's rising rapidly. The corporate bond markets provided about one-fifth of the credit that was provided last year to the private sector. And as I said, that's been growing rapidly. There's every reason to expect it to grow rapidly. And that is a good development. Everyone, I think, agrees that in a true market economy, it's helpful to have a good chunk of the financing provided through markets for those companies that are large enough to be able to be understandable, to provide the proper disclosures, and to have the kind of trading volumes that would warrant a bond market. Third component are the trust companies. They provide about a tenth of the credit last year, and that's up, I think it's about tripled from 3 years ago. It's gone up very rapidly. And it's a little difficult to predict, but it may rise significantly further from the levels at. Trust companies in China are an odd hybrid that you don't see in most countries, in that they're partially effectively banks, in that they make loans and hold those loans on their balance sheets. But they're also asset managers. They're probably a little more asset manager than bank. And they're also kind of an odd mix in terms of what business they generate themselves and what loans, for example, actually come through banks or other sources that they then package and sell on. Many of the concerns about the Chinese financial system relate to the trust companies. There's also, outside of the formal sector, there is the so-called shadow banking sector. That's harder to understand and certainly harder to get numbers for, because it's all those activities which are kind of like banking but aren't done by the banks or the bond market or the trust companies. And it ranges from straight-out loan sharking that's clearly illegal to pawn shop-type activities, loans by corporations to other corporations that are at best quasi-legal. And many people put parts of what the trust companies do into this area as well. It's hard to get good figures. The Financial Times has gone out on a limb and suggested it's about 20% of the credit origination in China, so it's quite significant. The authorities are understandably ambivalent. You might think they'd be outright against it because it seems to be an awkward situation to have so much of the credit provided by areas that are lightly regulated at best, and sometimes flat-out illegal. However, the formal sector is significantly too biased towards providing funds to the state-owned enterprises and other favored private entities. The small, really private firms without big political connections are a key, very dynamic part of the Chinese economy, but it's much harder for them to get money from the formal sector. The shadow banking sector has stepped in to fill that gap. So the authorities are looking for a way to allow the lending to small and medium-sized enterprises to continue to flow while bringing as much as possible of that shadow banking sector into a more regulated, more transparent environment. Moving beyond credit, stock markets in China are relatively developed, not nearly as much so as in the U.S., for example, but they're reasonably developed. The market capitalization of the Chinese stock market is about half of the size of the economy, of gross domestic product in a single year. Unfortunately, the stock markets are extremely speculative. And in Q&A, if you want, I can talk more about why they're speculative. But it does mean it's certainly not an ideal situation for raising funds for companies. You'd like what you'd really like is a market that's more dominated by longer-term institutional investors that are better informed. But that is one thing that China distinctly lacks, knows that it lacks, and wants to change, which is a large mass of institutional investors. For instance, asset managers, the equivalent of, say, our mutual fund managers. Asset managers in total assets is only about 5% of the size of the economy. For comparison, not that China has to become the U.S., but just as a comparison, the U.S. figure is 2 times GDP, not 1/20th of GDP. Massive difference. Another form of institutional investor that they need to grow larger is the insurance companies. The size of their assets is about 14% of GDP. That's about maybe a third of the level of the U.S. or of Europe. That would be good not just because of their role as institutional investors, but also because insurance through the private sector is one of the best ways of taking care of societal risks without having to make the government directly do that. So this is kind of the overview. I have, I am told, quite limited time, so let me just touch briefly on two other issues. One is a major theme in China is there's a moving away from government and party control of the financial system towards something that looks a bit more like what we have here or in Europe. More sort of commercialization, as it's often referred to. One of the things I find fascinating about China is if you look at the narrow question of how commercial the decisions are made by the banks on their loans, you get extremely different views, ranging from they're really not commercial at all and they basically just lend to the things the government wants to have money lent to the other spectrum that says, hey, they're not that different from Western banks right now. And there's a wide range of views in there. This is a theme to keep an eye on. I'd also stress something that to me is one of the major risk factors within China in terms of the financial system. There are so many implicit guarantees throughout the system that could go wrong. And by this I mean most of the lending activity in some ways relies on the assumption that somebody stronger than the borrower is actually standing behind the borrower. So you have the central government and regional governments backing the state-owned enterprises, central government seeming to back the local governments, governments seeming to back the banks seeming to back the bank, some of the trusts, banks and trusts backing up the loans they pool together and sell as wealth management products, government backing the banking system and deposits. There is no formal deposit insurance in China, but everyone assumes the government will protect depositors, and you could go on. The reason I emphasize this as a risk is in good times, implicit guarantees can work fine. In a crisis, if there is a misunderstanding about the extent to which those guarantees truly exist, or if because they're not written down, they morph and somebody backs away from what they seem to have been guaranteeing, you can get terrible panic that produce bank runs, things like that. So that's an underlying theme. But just to wrap up, let me say again, the financial system, I think, has done quite a good job the last 20 or so years. I think it will do reasonably well going forward. I'm not panicked about it. But there are a lot of challenges. The system's going to have to adapt to very different circumstances, and there may be some failures that will cause serious difficulties. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Shuli, it's your turn.
Hello, everyone, distinguished guests, old and new friends. We are here talking about the Chinese economy. Let me borrow the concept of the internet age. What's the killer app? What would be the magic formula to bring us comprehensive, sustainable growth? Here is my simple answer. Continue market-oriented reforms of the financial sector. If we up-package this simple answer, you would find a lot of things. Better allocation of capital, remove of financial restrictions, deeper reform of the financial system, and so on. And before we move forward, we should look back and see what has been done and how well it has been done. As many of you know, China's financial sector has been through reforms in the past decade. There were significant changes, including deeper reform of state banks, liberalization of interest rates and exchange rates, and a better management of securities companies. But many more things are left undone, and the market can't afford any more waiting. Through a series of official reports, Chinese government has charted the path to market liberalization, and they mapped out specifics on interest rates, on expanding the band of exchange rate fluctuation, and on direct convertibility under the capital account. These are good. But more important than progress in each of those topics is holistic institutional change. Following are some of the most critical institutional changes in my mind. First and foremost, the further openness for private sector and for market players. The financial market has changed not only in the sense of product, but also players. But the state still has a stake of more than 80% in the big four state-owned banks. And all the city commercial banks are controlled by local government. There should be concrete measures to increase shares owned by private players in these banks, and as well as the active participation of private players in wealth management, business, and other financial institutions. We need new policies, and to make that possible, new mindset of regulators. Second, in China's financial sector, there is both over-regulation and the lack of it. So it's extremely important to define the role of the market and the government, and to make them play the role they should play. Now, financial regulatory powers are divided and segmented. Unlike the regulatory regime, however, the market has witnessed a trend of comprehensive business and universal financial companies. The financial regulators need to catch up and be able to tackle the companies, such as universal banks, that are spreading across industries. One solution could be putting in place a coordinated regulatory system that's led by the central bank, so that policies are in sync, and there are more tools to carry out policies and more effective implementation. Finally, while deleveraging is happening in the developed world, China is the other way around, adding layers and layers of leverage to its economy and increasing the debt ratio. If economic growth stagnates, banks will face a tough bad debt problem, and the result will ripple through society. Chinese financial regulators must be prepared and be able to tackle severe crises. With that, I will stop here and look forward to hearing insights from fellow panelists. Thank you.
This is going to be a graphic and spatial presentation. Why I say rethinking China's financial reform is what I say rethinking, because I think that the general menu is fairly straightforward. If you talk to anybody, you'll say you should liberalize interest rates, you should strengthen the governance and regulatory framework, you have to deepen the capital markets, you have to liberalize exchange rates and open capital account. This package of recommendations is what I would call non-controversial. But if you go back 10 years, 20 years, you will actually see that the same recommendations are on the list. China's made progress in many of these areas, but the question is there something we should be doing in the future that we've actually missed? What are the priorities? Now, here in Washington, if you ask people, the main authorities, they will probably come up with 2 points they want to make. They'll first say that China's interest rates are too low, and this is a major issue. And they see that these low interest rates penalize savers and subsidize borrowers. And they would argue that this is leading to too little consumption, too much investment, and macro imbalances. So interest rate liberalization, raising them, is what many people would say the major priority. And the former Secretary of Treasury, a couple weeks ago, basically in an op-ed in Financial Times, essentially said, raise interest rates. The second corollary that most people would say is too much lending to the state sector, too little to the private sector. So these are what I would call the two issues that people would basically say is wrong with China's banking sector. Now, if these issues are the major problems, and they've been around for decades, why is it so hard to adjust the rates, and why is it so hard to lend more for the private sector? And what I'd like to basically point out is that the solution is a problem because it actually works against the source of China's success. So you're actually asking the system to change its policies in a way that historically has worked really well. And the major person who designed this was Deng Xiaoping. And I will call Deng Xiaoping what I would call the unbalanced reformer. Now, Deng Xiaoping 30 years ago basically said, I got a problem. I've got to revive growth. And what he did was, I'm going to concentrate along the coast. And I'm going to give all my incentives to the coastal provinces and those red circles in Guangdong, Fujian, Shanghai, and then along the coast. Those are all special export processing zones where he gave tax and investment privileges, and then he did down the Yangtze River, he did along the north, along the Russian border, and to Central Asia, and to the southeast. And the basic principle was incentives only for production and export, and I want a financial system that supports this. Now, he had a problem. When he looked at his budget, the budget had collapsed in China. Revenues as a percentage of GDP used to be above 30% when he started out, and you can see that it fell to as low as 10% by the mid-90s. So how do you implement a infrastructure investment program, production-oriented, when you have no money? And that's essentially the problem that China was facing for much of the last three or four decades. And he basically said, I'm going to use the banking system. I'm going to use financial repression rather than taxes. I'm going to basically channel the household savings to investments that the state would like to support. And he basically did this by controlling interest rates and limiting the opportunities where money could actually flow. Now, is this actually illogical? Not necessarily. If you actually control the interest rates on savers in the banks, lower the interest rates you pay them a little bit below normal, is this a progressive tax or a regressive tax? It's actually a progressive tax on wealth. It's very easy to collect. It's already there. I don't have to tax anybody. I don't have to move around. I got it right away. So financial repression in the Chinese system is an extraordinarily effective progressive means to get money to support investment. Now, the alternative would have been to have a sales tax because incomes are too low. But if you have a sales tax increase, it's regressive, extremely hard to collect, and to administer it in the way that you want, really, really difficult. So Deng Xiaoping was actually using a tool, and the system was using a tool, that was extraordinarily effective in promoting and getting resources of growth. The question is, do I spend it well? Because I can get it, but I have to spend it well. And he spent it mostly on infrastructure. And I'm using roads as a symbol. And if you go back to 1978, what is remarkable in China is that the road network is essentially even throughout the country. Under a socialist system, your infrastructure is evenly spread out, but totally illogical. It doesn't support production or commercial development. And you can see what the system did. It started investing infrastructure along the coast, gets darker and darker red, and then eventually is moving inland, and today it's basically everywhere. But the critical point I wanted to make here is your financial system or your fiscal system is not spatially neutral. Not only do you want to raise the money, you want to actually figure out where you want to put it, and the financial system is extraordinarily effective in doing that rather than working with 28 local provincial budgets, which the center can't control, working with 4 to 5 banks and basically saying where should you put the money very quickly, efficiently, over 3 decades, extraordinarily efficient system, the financial system. And you can't argue against success. This is the growth rate of China's GDP, but I've broken it down spatially. The blue line is the coast. The red line is the national. The green line is the central. And the orange line is the inner provinces. And you can see, aside from the dip in the Tiananmen years, an extraordinary burst of growth led by the coast, which really pulls out, and then today has reversed itself. The inland provinces are growing faster than the coastal. Now, this is an extraordinary, interesting story because it says an unbalanced growth process can lead to balanced outcomes, which is counterintuitive to anything we in the United States would ever think about. But this financial repression is a key vehicle. But China's economy is becoming more complex, market-driven. It cannot rely upon the same kind of financial model that was very successful in the past for the future. The 2009 stimulus program created a major debt problem. Therefore, China cannot rely upon credit expansion in the future. It's going to have to reform the banking system. But contrary to what we actually read or talk about, the key to reforming China's financial system doesn't lie in the banking system. It lies in the fiscal system. Because that earlier chart I showed you, the big problem in China is its budget doesn't have any money. And you have to then use the banks. So, but if you want to ease the pressure on the banks, you have to reform the budget. Now, here is the banking sector in China. And what you can see is savings, credit flows, money supply, as a share of GDP, is really large in China and excessively so. And that's a legacy of two things. The reliance upon the banking system to do the work the budget should be. And secondly, the extraordinary high savings rates of Chinese, which are sitting in the banks. So one thing you don't want in the future is that the banking sector actually gets any bigger. And as people have emphasized, you have to deepen the capital markets in other areas. But the real, what is really unique about China, its budget is so darn small. Here you have a socialist system. It controls all the resources. It provides a range of services, which is extraordinarily broad. You would think the revenue to GDP, the expenditure of the budget to GDP ratio would be large. In fact, it's way below normal. It's way below normal compared to the OECD countries, and it's way below normal even compared to other developing countries, and it's excessively below normal in relation to social expenditures. And you have this odd kind of a situation, a social system where the budget is actually too small rather than being too big. And here in the United States, of course, we're debating about the role of the government, whether it should be larger and smaller. But here's a social system where the budget is way too small. So the problem first is you cannot cure the financial sector. You cannot solve the financial sector problems until your budget becomes strong enough to carry out the duties that a budget should be carrying out. Now, the focus on interest rates, if you ask anybody, any analyst, they'll probably say to you, China's interest rates are too low. It must be raised. But factually, it's not even correct. China's interest rates, even adjusted for inflation, are actually higher than most economies. So this argument that interest rates in China are too low are, in terms of what's happened today, just basically not correct. Here is savings interest rates in China. The red line is the China deposit rate and the China inflation rate. Now, what this diagram does tell you is that right now interest rates in China are positive, but there are periods when it's been negative, and you see those blue inflation periods when China's interest rates are negative, and there are times when it is positive. What it does tell us is a couple of things. There is a rigidity in the Chinese system. The red line doesn't change very much in response to cycles, and the flexibility of China's system in terms of the need to improve flexibility is clearly an issue, but it's not necessarily the absolute level of the interest rates. Now, the bottom line is the U.S., and what you can see here is, in fact, real negative interest rates are much more of an issue in the U.S. than they are in China, but if you read the newspapers, you would think it's the opposite way around. And similarly for lending rates. Lending rates in China are more positive in real terms than in the West. So to argue that lending rates or interest rates are too low is what I would call actually not a really high priority issue. And I'm borrowing a diagram from Arthur Kroeber's CAVCAL, which basically shows that actual lending rates in China have actually started to become much more flexible and very high, actually, because of shadow banking and other product lines. So I think the interest rate structure is actually starting to behave in a way that we would all say is really working or moving in the right direction. So I don't think the focus on that needs to be as intense as it is, but it obviously needs to be encouraged a bit. So how do you improve what I would call the major issue in China, the governance of the state banks? And the problem is you have a state-owned banking system. So to tell everybody to behave and to lend on commercial terms and do the right things only gets you so far. It just doesn't work after a certain point in time. But yet that's what most people would say you have to do. You have to improve the governance of the banking system. And the big problem here is China's big four commercial banks are too big to manage. Here in the U.S., we talk about too big to fail, but in China, it's too big to manage. And they're too profitable to feel competitive pressures. The banks actually are very, very comfortable. They pay high dividends. Their NPLs are very, very low, even though the definition is flawed. They have massive amounts of savings. If you ask the banks, they don't feel any problem. So when you tell them to reform, why would they reform? They're actually too comfortable. Where do I put my money? I live half-time in China. I live half-time in the United States. Should I put the money in the Bank of America down the street or the Bank of China? Interest rate the Bank of America paying me these days is actually way below 0.28. I'm getting a tenth of 1%. I'm getting 3.88 in a normal savings deposit in China. I get implicit government guarantee, which is unlimited, whereas Bank of America gives me 250,000. And if I worry about exchange rates, I think the renminbi is going to appreciate. So I have all my money in China. And this is the problem. The banks in China really feel like they have a very nice life. So then you tell them, please reform. Prove your governance. Why will they? They won't. So how do you deal with this system? Because you can't privatize these banks. And here's where I want to be a little bit radical. How do you promote competition in a state-owned banking system? China's big four banks are too big to manage, too politically tied to Beijing. So I say break them up. Break them up into three banks each, possibly along regional lines, but allow them to compete across regions. The state should become a passive shareholder. They should no longer appoint the CEO of the big banks. An active shareholder board and not Beijing should appoint the shareholders. Move their head offices out of Beijing. so they don't have to be under the thumb of the state council every day and no longer visible. And when there are 12 of them rather than 4 of them, no single bank is that powerful. Right now, they're extraordinarily powerful individuals. But you have to provide Beijing or the state the confidence to let these banks go. And you have to strengthen the fiscal system so they can play around with the budget rather than play around with the banks. You should preserve the three policy banks, the Agriculture Development Bank, the China Development Bank, the Export-Import Bank. And if you want to play around with them for strategic or state purposes, so be it. But don't mess up the commercial banks. Let them become really commercial. Now, if you broke up the big four into, let's say, 12 banks, you start to do something which doesn't currently exist. You can create a constituency which would favor more foreign banks coming in, because right now these banks don't want foreign players. That's too much competition. But if you have 12, some of them will. And then you start increasing the force of competition from externally on the domestic sector, and you start getting change in a state-owned system. Thank you very much.
Finance is crucial for growth. That is a self-evident proposition to most economists who believe that once you look around the world, unless you have an economy that can intermediate domestic and foreign savings into productive uses in the economy, that economy is not going to grow. And then there's China. As we've heard, Chinese financial system has a variety of problems. It's very easy to catalog all the risks building up in the system, all the ways in which the system is not efficiently allocating capital, and yet it seems to work. So Yukon suggested an answer to that, and I think the reality is that given the state of China's development to this point, the financial system may have delivered in some ways, and there were workarounds in the system. But the big question now is whether the Chinese financial system, as it is now structured, is equipped to deal with the challenges of a much more complex and market-oriented economy. So in my remarks, I'm going to talk about financial market development, regulation, and the reform strategy. On the development front, China still remains largely bank-dominated, although over the last year, and Doug pointed this out, there has been something of a shift towards non-bank finance. Now, at one level, this is a good thing. You do want the banking system in a country to have competition. You do want to have depth in other markets, and China still doesn't have very much depth in certain markets that would be very useful for savers as well as for firms trying to get finance, such as corporate bond markets. And here the government is working hard to get those markets opened up. But the reality is that banks still are the major game in town. A lot more needs to be done, and here the tricky issue is how one thinks about matching up the development with regulation. And this is a very complex challenge that virtually every emerging market faces. And here we academics perhaps bear some of the blame for this, because we can very well tell you where you are right now, where you ought to be, but getting from here to there is complicated, and there are enormous risks no matter how you do it. So how you do it turns out to be really important. So let's take the banks in particular. Now, there are these four large banks that are dominant, but there are many other banks as well that have become increasingly important over time, especially the joint stock commercial banks. And then there is, of course, a part of the banking system, the development banks, that have a completely different function and are not even expected to operate on commercial principles. Now, it is important to recognize that while we think about the banks as doing funky things, lending in ways that don't seem to make sense, the banks are being perfectly rational. Like every other economic actor, they are responding to the incentives. So the right question to ask is not how can we get the banks to do something else, but how can we get the incentives right so that banks do the right thing? And this is where, again, things become very murky, because in a second-best world where there are lots of distortions already out there, it becomes very hard to figure out how to make incremental moves that can actually make significant progress without actually pulling you backward. If you think about the state-owned banks, they've been allowed to have much more liberal interest rates, especially in terms of lending. And it has had some traction in terms of banks lending more to the private sector, to smaller enterprises, which are intrinsically riskier. So if you can't price in the risk of lending to them, it doesn't make commercial sense. But yet, when you think about the incentives from an individual bank's point of view or from an individual bank manager's point of view, it's still very risky, not just in terms of the loan, but in terms of reputation. Right now, we hear that there is an attempt to try to deal with corruption issues. In this environment, if you think about a bank that has made a loan to a private enterprise, that enterprise goes sour. This might be a normal commercial assessment that the bank would have made, but there is always the question whether there was some corruption implicit in this transaction. On the other hand, you lend to a state-owned enterprise. There's probably a lot more corruption inherent in that transaction, but it is to a state-owned enterprise. So this is why, actually, despite the interest rate liberalization, although there has been some gap opening up between the actual lending rate, which is the weighted average of rates at which loans are actually made to firms, and the baseline lending rate, it's still a pretty small gap if you think about the enormous growth possibilities in China and how dynamic the private sector is. So in that sense, getting the incentives right, I think, is going to be crucial. And this ultimately is the difficult issue for banks, because banks now have much more liberal interest rate structures, especially on the lending side, but they don't have good risk management systems in place yet. And this is where the regulatory part becomes much more complicated, because by the books, Chinese banks look in some ways like the best banks in the world. They have very low non-performing loan ratios. They have enormous amounts of credit that they're lending out without huge amounts of risk apparently building up. They are very profitable, and yet we know that something is not right. And what is not right, of course, is the way credit is being allocated by these banks. So getting that part fixed is going to be the key regulatory challenge, making sure that banks not only have the right incentives, but have the right sort of regulatory mechanisms in place that allows them to do this. And again, the transition to a more commercially oriented banking system is going to be risky. And of course, once one thinks about those risks, the question is, where does a deposit insurance system fit into all of this? As Doug has pointed out, there isn't a comprehensive deposit insurance system in place yet, and yet there is an attempt to try to introduce a more formal, comprehensive deposit insurance system going away from the implicit deposit insurance system right now. The implicit deposit insurance system works great for the banks, because essentially people like UConn are not going to question twice where they put their money, because it is implicit. What I think the system needs is not only a more explicit deposit insurance system, but that system needs to be tested. Now, this is, I think, the dream of every economist and every policymaker, to have a small, manageable crisis, perhaps one bank failing, so that everybody learns. Now, this is very difficult to engineer, and the Chinese, I think, have been a little careful about this, but I think ultimately this is what it is going to come down to. If you want to get to a better banking system, there are going to have to be some risks taken, and I think the right approach will be to have some of these risks come out in the open rather than stay hidden in some sense as they are right now. And of course, in terms of thinking about what needs to be done on the regulatory front and on the development front, the list is very long. And this brings up the question of the strategy of reforms. And here, of course, being in Washington, any attempt at actually getting reforms done can be very impressive to one. But the Chinese have actually been going about it in a very sensible fashion. Let's take the banks again, and UConn alluded to this. Life is very good for the banks right now, because there is a much more liberal interest rate structure. But what is crucial is that there is a floor on lending rates, a ceiling on deposit rates. So the banks are going to make money for every yuan they take in and lend out. And that spread cannot be competed away. So while it is true that banks have a lot more liberal interest rates, the fact is that spread reduces competition enormously, and it prevents smaller banks from playing a much more active role. So I think we still have a long way to go in terms of interest rate liberalization, although just the notion that interest rates in China are too low may not be the only marker. We really do need to be thinking about the spread and what the entire interest rate structure means. So the banks find this to be very comfortable. The large state-owned enterprises and the provincial governments all are very happy with the present setup. So why would they want to change? It's not just the banks that don't want to change. And here again, I think the way the Chinese government has been approaching this in terms of thinking about frameworks for reforms is really important and strategically something that I think is going to work much better. Let me give you two specific examples. One was a plan announced earlier this year to reduce inequality. Now, when a government says we are going to work towards reducing inequality, it's usually a very bad thing because that means that redistributive policies are going to take over. But once you started looking through this plan, it turned out many of the specifics, and there weren't that many specifics, but in terms of the broad contours, it is exactly what the Chinese economy needs. More financial market reform, liberalization of interest rates, trying to liberalize capital flows, trying to think about getting the state enterprises to pay more dividends, strengthening the social safety net. But once you put it in this setup, then it becomes much harder for the banks and the provincial governments, which would like things to remain the way they are, to say we don't really want this because this is going to hurt the people. Because the entire framework is actually one of helping the people. So I think that strategic approach of having a framework is very useful. And in addition, when you look at the specifics, China still remains tied to this approach of incremental reforms, which perhaps is not such a bad thing given the enormous risk that I pointed out of going from where we are right now to the first best outcome. And if you think about the incremental moves on opening up the capital account, if you think about the ways in which they actually liberalized deposit rates to some extent at a time when they cut deposit rates. So basically what they did last year was to cut the baseline deposit rate, but at the same time say that there is a little bit of flexibility that banks have in terms of offering rates above that deposit rate. So from the bank's point of view, it was flexibility coming at just the right time. So the timing is crucial as well. So the second issue, which I'll conclude with, is how this ties in with the overall process of Chinese capital account opening and making the renminbi an international currency. And I know our moderator, Arthur, has written extensively about this even in a recent paper. Here again, I think the issue is not whether China is going to have an international currency, which intrinsically and in and of itself is a great thing, but it provides a framework. China is a great power. If you can convince the people at large that the Chinese are a great power and also need a powerful currency to match it, that gives you a framework for reforms domestically. Because if you want your currency to become an important global currency, you need to do certain things domestically. You need to have a more flexible currency. You need to have better financial markets. You need to have a more open capital account. And then all of these things can start happening. So I think the approach that the Chinese have taken, both in terms of thinking about where they want to go and how they are moving there strategically in terms of frameworks and in terms of specific steps, does provide some room for optimism. Thanks.
So thank you very much. I'd like to congratulate our speakers on being so concise. Could the panelists please come up and take their seats here at the front? Shirley, can you come up? And we'll open it up for Q&A. I think we'll break it around just a little bit before noon for lunch. And I've been instructed to say that a lunch will be served that way across the hall at the conclusion of this session. And then, Andrew, could you come up and join us? We have a special extra guest star on the panel, Andrew Sheng, who was formerly advisor to the China Banking Regulatory Commission and is now with the Fung Global Institute in Hong Kong. So we have a very distinguished panel. I'm not going to exercise my traditional right as the moderator to ask the first question. Instead, I will throw in one statistic, which is that based on my company's estimates, 2012 was the first year in which loans outstanding from the banking sector, from the banking system to the private sector, exceeded loans to the state sector. And I think that's a very important point as we talk about these financial liberalization issues, to recognize that, in fact, the financial system in China is changing very rapidly. Much more rapidly, I think, than is recognized outside of China. And while a lot needs to be done, there have been enormous increases in the availability of credit to the private sector over the past 3 years. And with that, I'm just going to open the floor for questions. So who do we have up here?
Mike Masetic again. Our first speaker talked about expanding the role of insurance companies in the Chinese financial system. I have to admit, I don't know much about insurance companies except to say in this country, everybody but members of Congress hates them.
Does anyone want to address the question of insurance companies?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Look, there are many essential services where people don't love the companies that provide them. Insurance is something where you pay them money, and in the good state, you never get the money back. So there's an intrinsic reason that people don't like them. And I think in the U.S., a lot of it right now is the healthcare system is very messed up. And so healthcare insurers are particularly disliked. But if you look at a country like China where the insurance system is fairly undeveloped, it means it's hard for private individuals and smaller companies to truly protect themselves in a good way from the things you worry about, your home burning down or the breadwinner dying early or whatever. Insurance really does provide quite essential functions. And it's there in China. It's just not at the level that it needs to be yet. And then, as I mentioned, for the financial markets, they're very useful investors. They can take a long-term time frame. They can look in a professional way and manage large pools of money.
I think was there a question in the back? Yep.
My name is Angela. I'm a graduate student from Georgetown Public Policy Institute. Since you are all experts in the financial system in China, so I'm going to ask you a specific question about microfinance. So what's your opinion about the microfinance future in China? Thank you.
Who'd like to take that? Andrew?
Very good.
Would you like to?
Market. You know, I mean, by and large, I think there is no doubt that microfinance can only grow in China. The problem is that, as we all know, if you actually give it too much attention, as some abuses can happen, as has happened with some of the Indian microfinance companies. Let the market decide for itself.
Okay, thank you. Here.
Thank you. I'm Francisco Martinreo. A lot of you mentioned this idea that the government has an implicit guarantee on a lot of the deposits and loans, but that seems to create somewhat of a perverse incentive that you know that you can loan to companies or businesses that aren't necessarily going to pay you back, but you know that if they don't, you know, the people's, you know, the savings that you're putting at risk will be backed by the government. So, you know, it's in your best interest as a bank to continue to lend as much money as possible, even if you don't necessarily think that the investments or the loans that you're making are good investments in the long term. But then a lot of you also spoke about the need to have greater participation of individual consumers, right, as shareholders of the banks you're using. You know, there's more transparency. But if you're an individual consumer in China, doesn't it seem difficult to get comfortable investing in banks when there's not enough transparency about what's actually in the bank portfolio? Does that make sense?
As an individual investor, actually, the Chinese banks look pretty good because they are very profitable given the structure right now. The question is whether the banks are serving the broader public good. So the investors are doing fine. The savers, UConn seems to be doing fine, but some other savers have a problem that they don't have alternatives, and over the years they haven't been getting great returns on their saving. Capital doesn't seem to be allocated very efficiently, so I'd be less concerned about the investors in the banks. But there is an interesting question. If one improved the corporate governance structure in these banks, could one actually get the banks responding to market incentives, not only in terms of their saving and lending, but also shareholders' interests? And in fact, one of the approaches the government took to improving corporate governance when things were stuck in 2005, 2006 was to bring in foreign strategic investors. Now, in retrospect, maybe bringing in Western banks to improve corporate governance wasn't such a great idea, but the concept was a very good one, that you want to have foreign investors who could bring in better governance practices and use that to shake up the system. It's not worked very well so far.
You can.
I think that implicit guarantees is a big problem in China, because if you're a bank and you lend to local authorities and you lend to them for building these ghost towns or other properties, and they don't repay you, you don't care too much because you think the government's going to come in or no one's going to penalize you. So that's the problem. If you're a saver and you put your money in the banks and you think that they're perfectly safe and everything's going on, you're also not very selective. So ultimately, China needs to move to the stage where implicit guarantees don't exist. And then if that happens, the bank's going to have to worry a little bit more about who they're actually lending to. And savers have to worry a little bit more about where they're putting their money. And savers also have to worry that if they're getting paid too high interest rates and something funny is going on, maybe they shouldn't be putting their money with that lending vehicle. So I agree with you on a general presumption. This is a vulnerability in the system. It creates tremendous distortions, and you have to move beyond that.
Here.
Hi, my name is Eric Lowe. I'm with the Fair Observer. My question is that, you know, like now with the situation with the EU and our system, basically the banks are too big to fail, and we don't know what the banks are investing in everything, and a lot of times that the government has to bail out some of these banks. So it would be actually a better solution that, you know, like the government sort of like has a more of a lid on the banks than the banks have more freedom to make bad loans. So I don't know how you balance the two sides up, you know, if you want to liberalize to a certain extent of how the banks can invest.
Doug, you want to address that?
Sure. I think we're dealing with a fairly basic point here. Do markets and individual players in markets collectively do a better job of allocating funds than governments do? I think most of us believe in the long run, private players collectively do a better job, but they're going to make mistakes. I don't think anyone can observe the world financial system without recognizing that not only do individual lenders make mistakes, but whole banking systems can get carried away in one direction or the other. So there's no way to eliminate problems in financial systems. It's a balancing act. But I think we probably all up here believe that the right place to eventually get to is significantly less state control, because that's more distortive than the distortions that a freer market would have.
I think there was a question back there. Yeah.
Thank you. Akira Chiba, Japanese Embassy. So why is the Chinese financial market so speculative? Is it because of an innate structural problem, or is it because the Chinese prefer mahjong to the game of golf?
since I virtually asked for the question, may I?
All right, yeah.
May I take it? I find it a fascinating question, because of course there are people who bring up these cultural stereotypes that, you know, Chinese love gambling, so of course they gamble on the stock market. But no, I think it's a more fundamental issue. Markets are supposed to operate so that if you make an investment, you're looking at the long-term prospects of the company you're investing in, because you'll get the money back through dividends or you'll get the money back through selling your shares. And if management is not operating in your interests in a truly free market, you can basically sell the company and let somebody else come in and install a better management. Well, if you look at China, the investor has almost no control over any of the things that matter at the company. First, there's an excellent chance that the company is majority owned by the state, so the investor has effectively no governance power with that. Even if it's not, takeovers are pretty rare in the Chinese market, so you don't so much have that option of kind of bringing in a new team. Dividends are lower than in many markets, so you're not getting your money back soon, and you don't have the ability to really affect what the dividend rate is, because your voting power doesn't mean that much. And not as bad as in some developing countries, but you do have to worry to some extent that management will find a way to move the money into their accounts through transactions on the side rather than have it stay in there. So you've got a market where, putting it in an extreme, you'd almost have to be a fool to judge based on fundamental values like we want them to, because there are all these other factors, including whether a company is in or out of political favor. So you can kind of see why the people who go into the stock market might focus on these speculative features. Now, I've probably overstated all this, but that's just to try to explain why there are structural elements here.
Shuli, you and your team have been following the Chinese stock market for many years. I wonder if you have a view as to why the stock market in China seems more like a Wild West.
Because investors are not very confident about the future of the market, so they intend to get short money instead of a longer one.
As a former securities regulator, can you name me which market in the world is not speculative at the present moment?
Fair point. Over on this side. Yeah.
Yeah, Bill Jones from Executive Intelligence Review. I'd just like to pose a question with regard to the panel. We're talking about reforming China's financial system. Nobody has really talked about the problems in the world financial system. And it's funny because China came into the international financial system as a low-wage producer when things were relatively good, but we were right on the cusp of a major crisis. And now that system is falling apart. China seems to be doing much better than, say, Europe or the United States because of that. And here we're trying to say these are the rules that we abide by, and they're looking at what the results of those rules were, and maybe they're a bit skeptical as to whether they should go exactly in that direction. I don't know. I hope that Mr. Zhang's comments would be translated. Maybe he addressed some of these issues. But it seems to me that when China is developing, that they're also coming in as an independent player, and they're coming into a system that is rife with crisis, and therefore maybe they have some ideas of their own to add to that situation, which would help resolve some of the problems we have, because right now that system is not functioning. It's falling apart, and what we're doing to our populations is certainly not a good example for the Chinese, who have a lot of problems of bringing their populations up and not pushing them down, as is now happening. Thank if you. Anybody would like to address that.
Ishwar, do you want to take a crack at that?
My hope is that we will move towards a situation where we have something of a convergence between where the emerging markets are right now and where the advanced economies were some time ago. Perhaps underlying your comment is this notion that in advanced economies, finance had gotten a bit ahead of itself, and Andrew has written extensively on this about the notion that finance should be there to serve the real economy rather than the other way around. My sense is that in a country like China, finance is well behind where it ought to be in terms of supporting the level of development that China could have, which although it's been very good in terms of bottom line or top line GDP growth, in terms of the balance of growth, in terms of the sustainability, I think a lot more could be done. Also in terms of the equitableness of that growth. The reality, however, is that even if you look at the emerging markets, there is a lot of demand for certain products. We think about things like derivatives as being exotic, speculative things, but these are things for which there is real demand among traders, among households who invest abroad. So I think the notion that financial market development and things like derivatives are intrinsically a bad thing is a problem. And the sense that we should abandon principles that, for instance, Doug has been talking about, corporate governance, better transparency, and so on, I think it's not the right lesson to learn. The lesson is perhaps that these were not applied in the West the way they ought to have been. So for a country like China to say, these guys talked about corporate governance, but look where it got them, I think would be the wrong lesson. The right lesson would be, these guys talked about corporate governance, they did the wrong thing, perhaps we should learn to do the right thing.
Thank you. Ken.
Ken Lieberthal, Brookings Institution. Everyone notes that there are significant implicit guarantees or contingent liabilities in the Chinese system, that they are wide-ranging and multi-layered. I'm wondering whether anyone has a good handle on what the magnitude of these are, what the structure of them is, and how specific major changes in the macroeconomy would reverberate through these implicit guarantees. In other words, how much changes if the growth rate were to slow for some period of time to 4%, you know, with a real downturn? Does that have a snowballing effect? In other words, you know, all financial systems have some implicit guarantees built in, and they can be hard to track. But in China, they seem to be large, but I've never seen something that really gives you a grip on it other than to say, well, they're there in a real crisis. That could be a real problem. Otherwise, they seem to be managing fine. Can you enrich that story at all, or is that the story that we have to stick with?
Who wants to pick that up?
Well, I mean, you know, sorry, you guys want to...
Ishwar, why don't you start, and then Andrew can follow up.
One way to try to get at that question might be to think about where bank credit is going and which of the firms that are financed by the banks are state-owned, and in particular are relatively weak state-owned enterprises, because there is, again, this paradox in China that a lot of financing is going to state enterprises, although that has shifted over time, but the state enterprises that are making profits have a lot of retained earnings, and they're not the ones going to the banks. So it's the weaker state enterprises. And this also creates an interesting issue, because I talked about this difficulty in a second best world of moving to the optimum. If today you told the banks you're on your own and any loans that you make, we are not going to back up. If you think about it from a bank's point of view, if you've already made a lot of loans to a weak state enterprise, if you pull the plug from that state enterprise, that immediately shows up as a non-performing loan on your banking system, on your books. So, in fact, you have an incentive, and this is what happened when they initially liberalized lending rates, that the discrepancy between actual and baseline lending rates rose up, and then it plummeted back to zero. Why? Because the large stock of loans was already with the weak state-owned enterprises. So the transition is going to be very difficult, because you need to figure out how to deal with the legacy problems. And I think you're asking, Ken, what is the size of the legacy problem? I don't know.
Andrew, do you know?
I think we're thinking about the problems. We need to be a little bit more creative thinking about this problem of implicit guarantees, because every country has an implicit guarantee. There's no way you can define it specifically. But one way of looking at this over the last experience is that who got into trouble in the Asian crisis, who got into trouble in the European crisis. There are countries with net investment positions, net owing foreigners to net what you owe foreigners, of 50% of GDP. In Asia, it was Indonesia, it was Philippines, it was Malaysia, you know, Thailand. All these were 50% of GDP. All went into crisis, right? And in the European case, all the countries that you can see, the PIGGS countries, are all the ones with 50% of GDP. So, you know, China today instead has a NIIP of $1.8 trillion, don't owe any foreigners, just like Japan. Basically, any implicit guarantee domestically can be solved, you know, through its external surplus position. So, you know, the question then is, how big is that? Now, as you know, the Chinese state-owned enterprises are not allowed to take any net derivative positions. So there are relatively few, you know, in that derivative positions. The net below-the-line foreign liabilities, below-the-line liabilities of the Chinese banking system, is about 17 trillion renminbi, which is roughly 2 trillion U.S. dollars, which is very small compared to the off-balance sheet, the shadow banking of the United States, which is $23 trillion, and $67 trillion internationally. So by and large, Chinese off-balance sheet liabilities are considerably smaller than its net asset position. Now, a lot of people talk about, you know, all these credit numbers look too large or grow too large. For every credit, there's a balance, there's an asset. Where is the asset? I mean, that's the key. What is the quality of the assets that's most important, right? And whether you're investing for the long term. Now, you know, so a lot of people talk about the local government financing platforms. What they don't realize is that, yes, the financing platforms have a lot of liabilities, but nobody has measured how much the cities have in terms of huge assets which are available to counterbalance the liabilities. Now, if you really look at the last growth in China, a lot of growth is in the cities. So the bank, they own banks, they own part of the large infrastructures, they own a lot of state-owned enterprises at the city level. Actually, the opportunity for China to deal with some of these so-called shadow banking issue is actually to go the second round of privatization, which enables those liabilities to be cleared up. And I have no doubt from the macro point of view, there's more than enough assets to clear up all these fast growth in liabilities, particularly in those sort of aspects. So I think we should not get it overblown. The major issue is not just the liability side, but where is the credit side? Where's the asset side?
Right. Thank you. Yukon, I think you wanted to.
I don't think there's been any overall comprehensive study of the point you made. But if you look at the local urban infrastructure authorities and their borrowings, people have tried to look at that and ask how much of that is okay, how much is not, and maybe 20% of it is not, and they realize that something's going to have to be done. If you look at the railway system, you realize they have a huge debt out there. Some of it cannot be repaid, so they have an estimate of how much that means. If you look at the overall lending of the banks, broadly speaking, you can make some estimates, and I've seen some estimates in the past based upon what happened 10, 15 years ago in terms of non-performing loans showing up later. And I think you might say to yourself that these non-performing loans based upon what I would call excessive credit flows to whatever the state sector might be something like a 0.5% to 1% of GDP annually. So maybe 8 or 9 years down the line, you might see a write-off of 8 or 9% of GDP. Less than it was the last time they did it, but still significant. Then you have conditional liabilities, the pension system, welfare system, which are building up. And how much of it is it going to be covered by the state, and how much does it have to come from other sources? So I've never seen one which – I've seen ones which try to look at some of these but never really tried to make it precise.
Yeah, I think basically any country would look pretty bad if you added up all of the implicit guarantees. A question over here. Yeah.
My name is Quinn Fan Tang from Johns Hopkins University. And Professor Shen just mentioned the shadow banking system, so I'm wondering whether you and the other panelists can elaborate a little bit about that, especially given the massive wealth management products issued by banks and cooperation between trust companies and banks. To what extent do you think they will cause a next bubble, or are they under sufficient regulatory system over the government? Thank you.
Who wants to take that? Doug, do you want to start with that?
Shadow banks.
Sure. And I know many of my fellow panelists know more about aspects of this, but to me, looking as an outsider, it's almost certain you're going to have some sort of blow-up in the shadow banking sector that will be significant. Now, I think it'll be at a level that can be handled by the larger system. I'm not suggesting this creates the doom of China or something, but you've got quite large sums of money that are being lent to particularly risky enterprises, which is why they have more trouble getting the money in the first place, without the backing of the implicit guarantee of the state in some way. And you don't have that much scrutiny of it, and you have the lenders operating with much less capital or other buffers. So it's ripe for something to go wrong, and it's been growing rapidly, which is another thing that creates risks. So I think you will have something go wrong. I couldn't tell you precisely what. But, yeah, I do worry about it. But, again, I think it'll be manageable at the end of the day.
Shuli, what's your view of the riskiness of the shadow financing system?
I think in the short term, everything will be all right. But it's difficult for China to avoid a real crisis in middle or long term. China face the challenges or threatenings from financial crisis in middle of 1990s, the Asia financial crisis, and in 2008 the world financial crisis, and China avoided all that. But
I think the crisis will come within China, not influenced by international world. And it's very challengeable. And I cannot imagine, actually, what will be the China's crisis. It will be very different from what we have ever seen.
Yeah. Could I just answer that question on shadow banking? This is a very, very important point. A lot of people think this is a crisis. This is not. This is market forces working. This is very different from the Financial Stability Board's definition of shadow banking. Shadow banking in China, one is a large regulatory arbitrage. The second one is actually market forces working. First of all, if you pay depositors, and I agree with Yukon, the numbers are much better in China than a lot of other places, but the fundamental problem is if the economy is growing at 6, 7% or more, right, in real terms, and you're being paid only 3%, actually, you know, there is financial repression. So that's the heart of the issue. And therefore, Chinese depositors would like, as they increase their wealth, would like more return on their wealth. And that's perfectly legitimate. That's a market demand issue. On the demand for a good product that gives you higher return. So that's not a problem. From the demand for loans, what had happened was that as the Chinese economy began to tighten under monetary policy, the property developers and the infrastructure developers and even the SMEs face a fundamental credit crunch. You know, either they continue investment or their property becomes a hole in the ground, as all property developers know, you know, right? And all infrastructure, you can't stop. So a lot of them actually ask for short-term liquidity loans in order to continue. And they were willing to pay higher interest rates. And a very good indicator of this is the Wenzhou shadow banking rate, which actually gives China a new market-determined rate to assess this. So there is a difference between the market rate and the official rate, lending rates. Now, these are beginning to narrow, as you can see, once the monetary policies begin to relax. So the crucial question, therefore, is ultimately the quality of the shadow banking assets. And there are basically three elements in there. There are the lending to real estate, the lending to property development platform companies, and then the lending to SMEs issues, right? In fact, the property development area, unless there's a major crash in the property market, which I don't think will happen, but it will, you know, there are by and large pockets of bubbles in select cities, but there's, you know, China is a very large continental economy like the United States. It's fairly rare for China to have a nationwide property crash, okay, in that regard. I don't think that would be a major, but individual property companies could have problems. Individual banks who lend to that could have problems, but the system as a whole was not that problematic. On the platform companies, my view is here is a huge opportunity for the Chinese to reform the municipal tax system, the municipal financial conditions. By the way, the municipals actually don't publish balance sheets and income statements. And this is an important fiscal reform that needs to be done, right? And you can develop the municipal bond market issue. The real area that is complicated and much more difficult to understand is actually the SME area, and that's an area related to the property rights reform. So in my personal opinion, the shadow banking system, what I call the scare, is actually a very good opportunity for China to make major reforms in the property rights and the whole financial market.
So if without property rights reform, what will happen for China's financial market?
Well,
Is that kind of systematical? No. The
thing is interactive. You know, financial systems determine property rights, and property rights are actually determined by, you know, the changes in the law, right? I mean, the banks basically enforce property rights. So the question you have in China, which is very unusual, and a lot of people don't understand this, okay? You need to understand this very, very clearly. In China, if you have a property right dispute between an investor and a bank, you normally ask the regulator to sort this problem out, not a court. Okay? Because that's the way it's done. The people always feel that they need to go to the regulator to solve this problem. But that's not the function of the regulator. In Hong Kong, for example, the regulator never gets involved in property rights dispute. You go to the court or you go to an arbitration panel, right? So actually, this is the area where China can reform this to get the regulator out of the dispute between the investor and the regulator. In shadow banking, if you get higher interest rate for a product, is it buyer beware or is it the seller is responsible? Who's responsible? You can't get a regulator to determine who's right or who's wrong. You have to get a court to do this. Right. But, you know, that's a market practice issue that will take time for China to evolve in this area. And I think it would be a very major reform in the Chinese banking system when you get the property rights clarity that you need to develop the system as a whole.
Great. Thank you. I want to have time for at least a couple or three more questions. So there and then in the back, please. Here. Yep. Wait for the mic, please.
Hi. I'd like to ask, what role should China play on a greater global scale in terms of the world financial, trying to bring some more stability in terms of the world financial system? Daniel Lamotte of Peace Quest. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Doug, you want to address that?
You know, one thing I've felt for some time, and I suspect there's broad agreement here, is we need the developing countries to play a significantly greater role in international financial agreements. You know, there's a Basel Committee of Banking Supervision, there's the Financial Stability Board, there's some other global bodies that try to bring together the key regulators and central bankers to create coordinated global approaches. China is represented in those places, as are some of the other developing countries, but certainly my sense in talking with people who are on these bodies is they've been relatively passive until quite recently. And I think one of the earlier questions was asking if we shouldn't be getting more input from the developing world. I think we should. We don't want to flip everything and go from a completely Western-centric approach to a completely developing country approach, but there's a balance. Everyone has a stake in this, and they ought to all be heard in a fair way. I think there are things we could do to help that along.
Thank you. There's a question in the back.
Hello, my name is Yiwan. I'm a current student from University of Minnesota Law School. I used to work for a commercial bank in China, like a loan officer. I have two questions. First, what's your opinion about the state-owned company between state-owned company and the banking system? Because when I work as a loan officer, whenever I contact clients, when I go back report to my boss, the first question they ask is not how the cash flow of that company or maybe how profitable it is. Is it a state-owned company? So it's my first question. And the second question is when I do the loan to this company, banks ask for the collateral, yes, as a security, especially the real estate. So my question is, what if the real estate market collapsed in China? How will it affect the banking system? Thank you.
All right, who wants to volunteer to?
I'm happy to, but I feel I've been talking too much. Is there? All right. And by the way, that's a rare thing for a think tanker to actually feel. No, I'm glad that you asked the questions, because those are both very central questions. On the collateral one, first I'd say, as compared to other financial systems around the world, I think the Chinese are somewhat too reliant in the banking system on collateral. But collateral is important in lending in every market, including the U.S. That's always a key thing. One good thing is it seems from the outside anyway that in China the level of collateral compared to the loan is high enough that it gives very considerable security. So I'm hopeful that short of a truly major real estate collapse, the collateral really will provide very considerable protection. You know, with home mortgages, down payments are 40-50% in China compared to U.S. average might be 10% at this point. There's a big difference. In terms of the commercialization, what you're touching on, it's a really key question, and I keep hearing different answers from different people who should know. So it's hard to tell. To what extent is it that the first box you check, is it a state-owned company in some way? Second box probably would be, you didn't say it, but I'm sure you would have volunteered to your boss, oh, it's not state-owned, but by the way, this is these guys, and they're really close to the governor, or whatever. So how much are those the factors? Or, for example, is a lot of the SOE lending because SOEs make more of the profits in the system than they make disproportionate profits on average. So you've got that. You've got the implicit guarantee. You've got perhaps stronger business structures for other reasons. What you're touching on, we could probably talk about for a full day. It's a really fundamental question, and I'd love to know what the answer is.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to try and squeeze in two more questions before noon. So we've got one there and then one in the back. So up here in the front, please. Here.
Hi, my name is Jian Chen, adjunct professor of Johns Hopkins University. I happen to work in the real estate finance sector, and I'm making a quick comment. I think the average down payment in U.S. now is about 20%, and in China I know it's much higher, maybe 30% to 40%. So I think that is the reason why the Chinese banking think they have adequate capital to cover property price collapse. But I think they haven't really identified the systematic risk or systemic risk. It's not only the real estate, the residential mortgages, but it's also the builder loans and the collateral of the government and the collateral for a lot of other companies. So it's possible that there is going to be a nationwide real estate price drop. And if that happens, I'm wondering whether the banking sector would have enough capital to cover their loss and still remain solvent. Thank you.
Yukon, do you want to take that?
Oh, just a couple issues. As Andrew said earlier, the property market is extraordinarily differentiated. You go to Beijing, you'll find projects which are highly, very valuable and projects which I would say are not going to make it. You have 70-80% of the people who bought property who found that they've appreciated 200-400%. You'd have to have a very sizable collapse to bring them down. You have others who've basically got into the market in the last year and done it in a very speculative way who could actually have a problem. So I don't see a systemic national issue, but I see problems here and there for different kinds of reasons.
Okay. And thank you very much for all the questions being so concise and for the panelists being concise. I know we could go on for another hour or two, but this is going to have to be the last question before we break for lunch.
Mark Jarvis with Ashmore. We're an investment management company. So I do agree that the development of the bond market is a good thing and the growth of the bond market. I am hearing anecdotally that a lot of the bonds that are being issued recently are basically repackaging of loans. They're being underwritten by the banks. These are loans that are maturing that maybe the borrower wouldn't be able to repay. But rather than being rolled over, they're just being issued bonds, or the borrower is issuing a bond, using the proceeds to repay the loan, and then the bond ends up on the balance sheet of the bank. So my question is this an accurate depiction? And if so, any idea of what the quantity of that is? How much of new bond issuance would that be?
Okay, Ishwar, I wonder if you want to address that briefly, and then we'll let Shuli have the last word.
It's a problem. The Chinese bond market is not quite the crapshoot that the stock market is, but there are severe regulatory issues that need to be dealt with. The concept of the bond market, I think, is exactly along the right lines. But in terms of the players right now, in terms of the depth, there are many issues that need to be addressed, and what you've pointed out is exactly along those lines. I don't have a good estimate of how many of the corporate bonds being issued are essentially repackaged loans. I have heard about this problem, but I don't have a magnitude to share.
And then, Shuli, do you want to finish up?
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. I just want to add that so far there's no one case of default on bond market. Even we heard so many noises or speculations, we warned as well, but there's no one case for that. Why? Because once something happened, even for a very small case, then local government would do themselves or suggest some certain SOE to help the problem companies to pay for their debt. So there's no one default. I think it's not normal. Oh, that's my answer about if it is good for Chinese bond market.
Okay.
I might just want to check
okay,
one
very quickly because we need to break for lunch.
Yeah. Just to factually, Chinese banks are not allowed to guarantee bonds. Factually. That's absolutely deregulation in China Banking Regulatory Commission. Okay. So, you know, if you ever see a bond guaranteed by Chinese bank, that's illegal.
Okay, and that, I think, is a very nice note on which to break for lunch. Thank you very much to the panelists. Lunch is across the hall. Thank you.